Good morning. In the peace building field, we do encourage participative communities. So when I say good morning, thank you. And welcome to the home of peace building. I was having a conversation with Mike Graham a little bit earlier, who's the CFO here at U.S. Institute of Peace. And I said, Mike, you know, we had talked about an idea of doing a very public peace building event. Mike Graham and Chick Dombach, who I know is here, and I, and it eventually led to this forum. And so I said, Mike, thanks for hosting us. And he said, well, it's your home. And I said, really? When can I move in? I mean, I have a wife and kids. I want a view of the monument. It would be perfect. And he said, no, it's not your personal home. It's the home of peace building. And so I thought there would be no better way to really start today than by recognizing what a momentous accomplishment and contribution the U.S. Institute of Peace has made to the peace-building community by shepherding and realizing the dream of this building and all the activity that is happening here. So please join me. We have Ambassador Solomon here. Thank you very much, Ambassador Solomon, for this. I understand the mortgage is in your name. Is that right? Okay. So I'm Rob Rossigliano. I learned this week, Alliance for Peacebuilding annual meetings that my full-time job is as chair of the Alliance for Peacebuilding. I occasionally show up at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee and do my other job. I was asked to give a short introduction this morning and to build that way in the Alliance program, and I assume that's a reference to the fact, or not a reference to the fact, that I'm 5'7" tall and more than I'm not going to speak for very long. So I really do want to just frame a couple of issues for you for today. Ambassador Solomon, Melanie Greenberg, who's the president of the Alliance for Peacebuilding, will give proper thank yous and acknowledgments in a bit. But I wanted to start with a framing, a substantive framing of our task and the importance of what we're doing today. So there's two things I wanted to talk about. One is to take stock of what's at stake for us here today. So we're talking about managing complexity, looking at 21st century conflicts, taking stock of them, and this very important task of how do you manage complexity. And the stakes were clarified for me yesterday at one of our Alliance meetings. One of our speakers had referenced an article that Greg Jaffe had published in the Washington Post on the 10-year anniversary of 9/11, in which his point of the article was that what's different post 9/11 as different than other conflict periods has been that war now is the norm. This is Jaffe's point. War is now the norm, and peace is seen as the aberration. And I really started thinking, why is that? Where is that coming from? He said it wasn't that way after World War II and other conflict periods. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that people see the 21st century conflicts as being qualitatively different. They're messy. We don't have a very clear enemy. We don't have territory we can conquer and stamp this problem out. And that what's at stake has been one of the ways of grappling with that complexity is to say, make war. We that's the only approach. It's too difficult for us to grapple with. So we have a lot at stake. We in the peacebuilding community have a lot at stake, which is showing that that is not the appropriate or even the useful response for managing today's complexity, the complexity of today's conflicts. The second thing I wanted to do was to give you a task, a challenge for today. So the topic is grappling with complexity in today's conflicts. And as I've written a book on this subject that came out last month, but as I found in writing that book and thinking about today, wouldn't you know it, managing complexity is itself complex. So there are really two kinds of complexity that we're grappling with. The first is what I would call the complexity out there. So it's the complexity in Afghanistan, in Cambodia or Nepal or the various contexts that we're working in. And there's some good news and bad news. I mean, the good news is that we've seen lots of development of new tools and strategies for grappling with this complexity. There's those of us who have worked with the USAID or the Defense Department. I think there's no complexity in the State Department. That's right. Ambassador Barton will tell us that in a minute. Working with the U.S. government, USG interagency, on managing complexity, and there's a lot of really innovative thinking that's happening and practices and tools, and seeing that in Europe and other places, that's really good. what we also have to realize is that we have a lot of really well-ingrained bad habits for dealing with complexity. And so one of them is when people see complex environments in places like Afghanistan, they can't deal with that. So what they do is they want to find the routine slice of a very complex environment. So they want to block everything else out. I build health clinics, and darn it, I'm going to build health clinics in Afghanistan. I don't do security. I don't do trauma healing. I don't do economic development. And, you know, if I do my job right, other people will do that other stuff, and it's kind of a faith-based initiative. They'll all add up to something better. And the truth is it doesn't actually add up. So we fall into the trap of dealing with complexity by only focusing on a routine piece that we can control and handle. The other response is to treat complexity as if it were completely chaotic. So there's nothing we can do, which is part of the reason why we have that sort of war is the norm mindset. It's sort of throwing up the hands. It's either walking away or just not thinking very rigorously or very long about how to manage complexity. The other kind of complexity that I want us to keep our eye on is actually, I think, is the more difficult brand, and that's the complexity in here. So opposed to the complexity out there, it's the complexity in here, meaning within the peace-building field, within organizations like the USAID and Defense Department, U.S. government generally, other governments, and so on. We are in here. We got to be honest about the fact that we're addicted to a lot of practices that will make it very hard to grapple with complexity out there. So, for example, we talk about monitoring and evaluation. We talk about accountability. And we also want to learn. The problem is that we tend to stress accountability in ways that stamp out learning. So there are folks who talk about the need to learn from failure and be error embracing. I don't know if we have any AID folks here, but if in my report to AID, I'd say, I embraced all of my errors and I really messed up a lot of stuff. That would not go over very well to my donor. So we have a lot of bad habits. We are addicted to control and predictability. As opposed to flexibility and adaptability, which are critical in complex environments. We tend to want to impose change on situations versus working with systems. Very, very difficult. So there's a range of practices that we have internally that make it very difficult to grapple with the complexity outside. So as we listen to today's panels, the various speakers, and we've got a wonderfully rich set of speakers and panels. We have a simulation this afternoon. Think about those two questions. So what are we learning about how to grapple with the complexity out there? And more importantly, how do we grapple with the complexity in here for us as individuals, for us as organizations? So I want to leave you with that challenge, with that acknowledgement of the stakes that we have here, the tasks, the complexity of the tasks that we have here. And I want to get us into the rest of the morning. And again, thank you all for being here. Thank the Institute, the Alliance for Peacebuilding, also for putting this on. So let me hand this over to Ambassador, the man who needs no introduction, President of the U.S. Institute of Peace, Ambassador Dick Solomon.
Well, I was preempted a little bit by some of Rob's introductory remarks, but I just will reiterate that from the point of view of the Institute, we see this building as a community resource. I tell that to all of our friends and skeptics in Congress. We hosted not too long ago the 50th anniversary of the Congressional Black Caucus, and I keep telling people, do more events here, and I could give you a fairly impressive list of other folks from Congress. Since they paid for about two-thirds of this building project, I keep saying to them, use the facility. And I think they're getting the message. But for many of other of our other friends, collaborators in the work that we do, we're just delighted that we are able to host events like the one we're doing today. And we owe a special debt to the Alliance for Peacebuilding and its many agents and spies working up on the Hill, et cetera, who have made a major contribution as we, the Institute, have gone through a very challenging year. I don't need to go into gory detail, but I think you're aware that this past year there were efforts to not just eliminate our budget, but to eliminate our charter. And we all spent a lot of time working with our friends from several organizations, making sure that people on the Hill understood the value of our work. As I'll comment in a couple of minutes on some detail, one of our biggest supporting communities has been the military, that they understand full well the value of what we do. And so we came out of the trials of the 2012 budget process, I think, in a stronger position. And without going into detail, we just had a very reassuring development to come out of the House appropriation process for the coming year, for the 2013 budget, which indicates the measure of support that we do have, not just in the Senate, which has been the core of our traditional support. As you know, we were really a Senate creation, and at key points, our supporters in that body have come to our rescue, but very much this past year. So, again, we are deeply indebted to the Alliance and delighted that we're here to collaborate today. Managing complexity. I don't want to cut into Rick Barton's time, but let me say a few words about that concept. If we can step back from the daily headlines and the specifics of our work, we're living in a remarkable breakpoint period in history. I've got enough gray hair to look back on at least three instances where the character of international relations and international conflict have changed dramatically. I was born the month that Japan invaded China back in 1937. And this country, remarkably, overnight, with the start of World War II, went from the isolationism of the 1930s to involvement in a major way in, of course, the great conflict of World War II. That was a break point that's remarkable because overnight we switched gears. We went into an industrialized warfare. We built a major international coalition, and we prevailed in what looks like a short war for 4 years. The second major breakpoint, of course, was the onset of the Cold War. And what's important to note about that experience is that it took us over 15 years to figure out how to deal with a Soviet challenge, from the subversion of Czechoslovakia through the Cuban Missile Crisis. We were trying to figure out, you know, what was the way to respond to a very complex environment of political subversion, new weaponry, and a very determined adversary. And as you know, we came out of that period with deterrence, containment, as concepts that guided us through the Cold War, and the good Lord willing, we prevailed, and the Cold War ended not with a bang, but a whimper. The third period that we're really now into and grappling with, in a sense, had its onset with the collapse of the Soviet Union, and only a couple years later, the first attack on the World Trade Center in 93, and then, of course, the big attack in 9/11. And I think we're in a period where, given the theme of complexity, we're struggling, all the agencies of our government and many countries around the world, trying to figure out the character of conflict today and how to deal with it. Now, Rob, I'm not going to get into a debate right now, but Rob stress the issue of, you know, is war the current norm? I'm thinking of Steven Pinker's new book, which says, hey, in fact, if you look at world history, the use of violence and warfare actually has declined significantly. It may be that what I personally view as a strategic blunder of the intervention into Iraq in 2003 was really the last time we will see this kind of warfare, barring some surprise. And of course, the world is full of surprises. But we are in a period where we are still trying to figure out how to deal with not the kind of conflicts that we dealt with, state-to-state confrontations or conflicts that required major military interventions, but a much more complex environment that ranges from the kind of terrorism or the security challenges that we face from an organization like Al-Qaeda to the great challenge and concern with issues of nuclear proliferation. So it is a major period where this group and the work of the Institute are trying to figure out what is the right mix of responses. Part of the responses are understanding the character of conflict today, and it's not just imperial-minded nation states, as we all know. It's a much more complicated environment. And we're looking at concepts, trying to come out with the best practices, understanding what the issue of ripeness is, as it gives opportunities for negotiating settlements. The requirements of building coalitions today in a very different international environment. But it is also the challenge of bureaucratic complexity. And one of the points that we're all well aware of is the need to break the traditional stovepipes or sort of isolated activities of the different big agencies of not only our government but others, where the collaboration among the various agencies that would be required to deal with a situation are proving to be a real challenge. Now, I see real changes just in the agencies of government that we deal with, and just two or three recent examples. A couple of years ago, the Chief of Naval Operations called me, Admiral Roughhead, and said, we have these disaster relief operations. They're very important for our access around the world, building friendships and collaborative relationships. Will you, the Institute of Peace, help us establish a working relationship with the NGO community? Because we need their humanitarian assistance activities, capabilities, and we can provide the transport, the communications, the security environment, but a situation where they are reluctant to collaborate with us. So we got those folks together with the Navy. They ended up negotiating a protocol for their interactions, which would preserve the operational requirements of both sides. And it is, I think, contributed to our military's ability to conduct humanitarian assistance operations. Earlier this week, I had dinner with a very senior military official who had commanded a combat brigade in Iraq. He had worked with our people who had helped negotiate some of the local tribal conflicts that required his troops to remain in a certain area. This senior officer was taking casualties, and our contribution in helping through political means resolve local conflicts meant that his casualties went down to zero. He was able to redeploy his troops, and out of that has come a recognition in more than one senior military officer of the value of collaborating with the Institute and other agencies. This senior officer is talking about the need for prevention. He emphasizes the need to understand what he calls the human domain of the conflict environment, that is the culture, the political dynamics of the communities in which his soldiers might be deployed. Several years ago, the State Department asked the Institute to help mediate between the Philippine government and a Muslim insurgent group down in the southern island of Mindanao. And over a four-year period, our regrettably recently deceased colleague, Gene Martin, did a remarkable job of bringing up to the edge of a very important agreement, a resolution of the so-called ancestral domain project in the Philippines. So I'm reasonably optimistic that however long it is taking, we are seeing the concept changes that and the restructuring of our big bureaucracies for dealing with this much more complex world. And your work and our work, our collaboration, I think, are a very important part of that that transformation. So we're delighted to host you here today. I told Melanie that I was impressed that you're 3 or 4 days here. You're going from institution to institution. You've been at the Wilson Center. You've been over, or you're going to SAIS. You're here. The only institution you really should also add to your magical mystery tour maybe is the Holocaust Museum, where we're doing some collaborative work on the genocide prevention issues and the R2P responsibility to protect issue. So I am optimistic, but it's going to keep us all very busy, productively so, for I think quite a few years as we make this transition into the 21st century. Melanie, I'm delighted to welcome you to the podium. You've been a wonderful friend, supporter, colleague, and along with Rob, with Chick Dombach, and all of you here, we're delighted to have you with us. Thank you.
Welcome, everyone. Recognizing that I'm the only thing standing between Rick Barton and his speech, I'll be very brief. But first, thank you very much, Rob. Thank you very much, Dick. I've known you for 12 years now and worked with you, and it's your leadership that has made both this magnificent physical space and this home for our community possible. But much more than that, you've created the intellectual space for the peacebuilding field to bloom. It's thank you very much for that. I'd also like to thank Ambassador Barton for being here today at the beginning of your tenure in a new bureau at the State Department. You have been such a wonderful friend to our community for so long, and we are so grateful to you and want to welcome you. Thank you. I'd like to thank our USIP planning team. Emily Malozzi and I from AFP have been working with Pamela All, Sheldon Himmelfarb, Jeff Helsing, and Matt Levenger, and it has been such a satisfying and joyful collaboration. Planning conferences like this takes tremendous attention to detail, and we've enjoyed every minute, so thank you. AFP staff, can you please raise your hands? That today would not have been possible without the work of our wonderful staff, and I feel it's a privilege every day to come and work with you, so thank you for all that you do. As I think about being here today with all of you, I think of a tale of two tables. In the first table, about 8 years ago, I sat down with Moshe Safdie, the architect of this beautiful building, at a dinner that USIP held for its advisory committee. The first mock-up of the building sat on a little coffee table, and Moshe Safdie talked to me about the vision that he had for this space. He even sketched out a little bit on a napkin. I wish I'd kept it. He thought about a space that was monumental enough to uphold the noble goals of peace, that was light and transparent enough to represent the underlying principles of peace building, and solid enough to represent the work, because it is work, that we do to attain peace in the world. It's tremendously moving for me today to be here to see this vision come to life and to be holding our first joint conference with USIP. So I want to welcome all the friends of USIP here today. At another much more modest table 12 years ago, the founders of the Alliance for Peacebuilding sat around my kitchen table. I had just taken on the role of program director at this Hewlett Foundation running the conflict resolution program, and a number of leaders of the conflict resolution field came to me and said, could you help us? Our field is so competitive, it's so atomized. We're spending so much time competing for scarce resources. We have so little coordination for creating a unified voice. Would the foundation give us some funds to put together a group that could represent the voice of, at that time, we didn't really call it peace building. It was really some combination of conflict resolution, conflict management. So to be leading this organization now, I'm extremely grateful to Chick Dombach, who's here, for building such a beautiful, strong foundation for AFP, continuing to be a friend of ours and working for our cause on the Hill as Chief of Staff to John Garamundi. to be leading the organization with 80 organizational members, several hundred practitioners, and strategic partners in a wide range of sectors related to peace brings me great satisfaction. I'm inspired by the passion and energy of our members, many of whom are here today, and the real change that all of you are creating in the most chaotic and complex areas of conflict around the world. It's a great privilege and honor to be working with you and to welcome you here today. I want to give a final thank you to my parents, Jane and Larry Cohen, who are in the audience. My father is a cardiologist, my mother is a social worker, and together they taught me much of what I've learned about peace and healing. So thank you, thanks to all of you, and we look forward to a rich and rewarding day. Pamela All, who is Provost of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding, will introduce Ambassador Barton.
Yes, I'd like to add my welcome to all of you here in the room. It is great to see you here. We've been planning this for a few months, and it is wonderful to see this in fruition, but I also know it's the first time for some of you in this building. And so a special welcome for the first-time visitors. My name is Pamela All. I am the provost of the Institute's Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding. And it is my great pleasure to introduce Ambassador Rick Barton, who is the new Assistant Secretary of State for Conflict and Stabilization Operations. Rick knows all about conflict complexity, and also about silos. He has worked in some of the most prominent institutions of international affairs, the State Department, USAID, the UN, and even the Center for Strategic and International Studies. So he knows all about silos, but he also knows how to break them down. He has been absolutely remarkable in his career for being able to bring people together to get them to talk across communities. He is now leading a great big new effort that we are very, very excited to be working with, and delighted that it has come to fruition. And with that, Rick, I'm going to turn over to you, and we look forward to hearing what you think are our challenges and how you're going to solve them.
Thank you. Thank you, Pamela, and thanks to all of you, all friends. I do feel as if I am home, and I do feel as if USIP is our home. And so it's just a great, great pleasure to be among so many peace builders. All of you have dedicated so many wonderful years and superb efforts to this cause. And so as I look around the audience, I just see people that I've admired for a long time, your dedication, your professionalism, your perseverance. One of the things I'm finding in this new job is that tenacity seems to be a fairly important quality, and it's not one that I would have necessarily have put at the top of my personal list, but I'm finding that there must be more of that New England strain than I realized before I moved into the State Department in this particular job a few months ago. But all of you have clearly shown that, and thank you so much. Without it, we wouldn't be making the progress that we are today. Thanks to Melanie and Dr. and Mrs. Cohen for the gift. Obviously, Chick Dombach. And I think there are a bunch of other old friends here that deserve mention, but clearly Bob Loftus, my predecessor at SCRS and then CSO, who's here in the middle of the audience, you probably should stand up as well because he's made it possible for us to build on a pretty solid foundation. Bob. And he's here now at USIP as well. So we stand at a breakthrough moment, a chance to make the U.S. government more effective and coherent in building peace. And we must seize this opportunity. To do that, we'll need your continuing help
and openness to change. At CSO, our mission is to prevent violence and accelerate the departure from violence. We're trying to fashion an organization that can make an impact on policy and in programming in the first 12 months of a crisis. It's a high bar. And every time over the last 6 months that I've told people about our mission, I've heard the same two words spoken quite differently. Good luck and good luck. In both cases, people want us to succeed, but I also hear concern that making an impact in some very challenging places is just too tough. We know we have a lot of work to do. All of us face difficult challenges, not only in the places we work, but with the attitudes and the structures that confront us. For example, we know that almost 80% of recent conflicts stem from violence recurring within 2 years of a settlement or ceasefire. Why? We know that donor countries' spending priorities in developing countries are remarkably consistent regardless of whether a country is at peace, in civil war, or recovering from war. Why? We know that an astounding 62 U.S. offices were involved in managing Iraq reconstruction. Why? To answer these questions, to be more effective, we see the need for some fundamental changes. The U.S. has spent significant effort and money in the last decade to address conflict. But whether we spend $3 million or $3 trillion, we haven't gotten it right. But with your help, I believe it is possible. But we also know that work like yours at the local level has contributed to the longer-term decline in conflict around the world. I believe we are on the cusp of historical change, as Dick mentioned. I believe that this is change you have worked for and dreamt of for a long time. I believe that your work has brought us to this tipping point moment, and for that, I thank you. Making history is not easy, but I believe that if we can work differently and work together, we have an excellent shot. Many of you have been on this road for quite a long time. It's not hard to see a narrative arc to the work at both the grassroots and international level. Development groups that saw the links between violence and poverty began working to address the root causes of conflict. Organizations like Search for Common Ground and Partners for Democratic Change began to practice this work more systematically. Academics began to define its boundaries and train practitioners. I'm speaking of this like distant history, but many of those people are in this room today. Meanwhile, the field began to take shape at high levels everywhere. In the early 1990s, the UN began to recognize our work as a distinct discipline. In 2005, the UN established the Peacebuilding Commission, Peacebuilding Fund, and Peacebuilding Support Office. In 2008, the UN adopted its latest definition of peacebuilding, only 121 words. And of course, the Quadrennial Diplomacy and Development Review, the QDDR, released at the end of 2010, identified conflict prevention and response as a core mission of the State Department and led to the creation of CSO. Secretary Clinton has told me and anyone else who will listen that CSO is one of the most important things to come from the QDDR, so I know she is invested in our success. By the way, I don't mean to suggest that CSO is a crowning achievement of this movement. In fact, the U.S. must improve. But I do think that elevating these issues at state, giving them heft, has been on many of your minds for some time, and it's a great honor to have the chance to try to bring it to life. The QDDR reflects the broader fact that we have reached the critical mass of people who have built a shared language and understanding of the need to analyze conflict, plan what needs to be done, and work together to do it. We are coming to the greater recognition that building democracy, human rights, economic development, or health all build peace. Whether we call it peace building or stabilization or something else, we all need to work together to seize this moment. Now, where will CSO fit into this rather crowded space? Our ambition is essentially to be more effective in an increasingly dynamic world, as Rob and Dick described. As I mentioned, even within the U.S. government, we haven't seen the best cohesion and coherence in our work on conflict. Effectiveness also means a recognition that the U.S. is going to be a pivotal and vital player, but not always a dominant force. We need to be humble. So we've got to think about the length of our stay in a place and the resources available right from the beginning, rather than saying we'll get in there and make it up as we go along. Effectiveness also means boosting the impact of local ownership. Everybody talks about local ownership and sustainability, but I still don't believe that we do it. And frankly, we need to. We can't travel as freely as we used to. We need to expand our partners. We need to get around standard bureaucratic excuses. And we don't want to get into a place and end up owning the problem. We've got to be much more agile in what we do and who we can count on to do other things. We must bring a new sense of focus and urgency to this work. What we are offering at CSO is essentially a process. It starts with determining a center of gravity for each engagement, someone with cross-cutting authority for the network of offices and people involved who welcomes help and encourages innovation, so that, if heaven forbid, we have 62 agencies working in a place, they know what each other are doing and they're working with each other from the start. We think of it as a board of directors model. Engage at the front end as many people as have an interest in the case. Be inclusive. Bring them all to the policymaking table. Give them a chance to make their best arguments, but come to a decision on the way forward so that everyone buys in and no one can take a shot at it later. With that, we then need a fast, rigorous analysis that is built from the latest local realities, in and outside of the Capitol. When the Secretary interviewed me for this job, we talked about how when she visits a country, she ends up inevitably with the same list of deliverables, irrespective of the case. It's often terrorism, narcotics, AIDS, refugees, food security, all good causes. If you tell me which office or bureau is going out to do the analysis, I can tell you what kind of solutions they're going to come up with. We want to avoid an institutional bias or predetermined responses and instead answer the question, what is most needed? We just helped with this kind of analysis in Burma. We worked on a 7-person team with 3 members from AID and 4 from the State Department, including 1 from CSO, under the auspices of Derek Mitchell, the special envoy. We were just trying to make sure that those local voices are heard and that they drive the thinking that takes shape. As you know, CSO has its own analysis tool, the ICAF, and I know that many of you have yours as well, and that sometimes they produce different conclusions. We want to learn from you and refine the ICAF in large part to make it more strategic and influential. The analysis that we all do should lead to the next step, a single integrated strategy with 2 to 3 priorities that provide direction for all. Many of these places need everything, so you can never be wrong, from infrastructure to schools to justice systems. But the U.S. can't be in a nation-building mode. Jump-starting is still plenty ambitious. And we can't afford to work on priority numbers 7 or 8. We need to be on 1, 2, and 3. We have to be catalytic and make sure that those local people have the ability to make it on their own. Next, the strategy leads directly to making sure that people and programs, resources, address the priorities. Burma will be a challenge in this regard. It's exotic, It's safe. Everyone wants to work there. But to work coherently together will be a centerpiece of our being effective. Finally, we need to make sure that we are measuring and adjusting our work as we go, learning in real time and not 2 years after the fact. With this approach, I think we in the U.S. government can greatly increase our chances of success, and it will help us work better with all of you, hopefully in a transformational way. At CSO, we recognize that we have the coming year to prove that we can improve the response to show change and impact. So for this year, we told the Secretary we have three goals. First, we have to make an impact in 2 to 3 places of real significance to the United States. To do that, we will dedicate 80% of our effort to 4 major cases. Right now, they are Syria, Kenya, North Central America, and Burma. Then we'll have another 8 to 10 places where we can test new approaches or make a welcome difference by just sending the right person at the right time. So far, I think we are gaining traction in each of our major priority engagements. Many of you are working in these places, and we realize that we won't know it all or know best about them, so we hope for your support. In Syria, we are providing a non-traditional surge to empower and unite a fractured, nonviolent opposition. As the Secretary announced, that includes providing non-lethal assistance. We are also working with partners to set up an outpost for the internal opposition to coordinate and communicate with the international community. In Kenya, we are helping to develop plans to ensure peaceful and credible elections a year before the vote. Incidentally, Kenya is one place where we've seen a potential model for broad cooperation and innovation. In northern Central America, we have a growing homicide and governance problem that could spill over and affect our interests more directly. So we are bringing new urgency to address the violence on a regional basis, specifically to Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Belize. In Burma, as I mentioned, we are supporting analysis and focusing on ways to connect with ethnic minorities at the subnational level. Our second goal for this year is to build a trusted and respected team. We want to be the people in the U.S. government who bring everyone together to find solutions to conflict. We've brought in an entirely new leadership team, refocused our predecessor organization, SCRS, and are restructuring the Civilian Response Corps and other core resources. We are reducing the size of the Permanent Corps to a proven leadership cadre who can lead our engagements. At the same time, we are expanding our reach to deploy experts from inside or outside the government on a pay-as-you-use basis. So instead of keeping a large standing staff just in case of any eventuality, we are moving to the ability to deploy the right person to the right place just in time while expanding our partnerships. For example, this is one of my favorite stories. We recently got a call from the U.S. ambassador in Liberia seeking our help. The day before the presidential runoff in November, a demonstration turned violent and one person was killed and 8 were injured by gunfire. Some felt the police were implicated. The Liberian Commission set up to investigate the incident didn't have the capacity to conduct an inquiry, which in turn put the credibility and goodwill of the government at risk. CSO sent an expert from the Justice Department and our Civilian Response Corps who assured the investigation was on track. Liberian investigators interviewed 70 or 80 people and found a 15-second slice of video of the demonstration that showed specific police firing on the crowd. It actually happened in 3 different ways. One of the Liberian investigators first saw a plainclothes person in a rather exotic shirt with a heavy armband firing into the crowd. Actually, the video showed a pop, a little bit of smoke, and you could hear the noise. And still photography confirmed who that person was. It turned out it was a high-ranking member of the Presidential Guard. That same 15-second clip was shown to the Department of Justice investigator, who then saw another policeman in the same frame shooting, this one in uniform, shooting into the crowd. He then showed that same video clip to the commission members, the Liberian commission members, and one of them then saw a third person in that same 15-second clip firing into the crowd. That became the critical evidence that has led to police suspensions, further investigation, and the president of the country taking responsibility. It's a great case for the rule of law and for the strengthening of the political process. It also shows that who we are and how we work are as important as what we're trying to do. To make quality impact in the first 12 months of a crisis takes agility and innovation that's different from the way the U.S. often works. Our third goal is to work in a more agile and innovative way. Part of that is developing a model for expeditionary diplomacy in the field, and part is working as an antidote to the bureaucracy in Washington. As we know, the bureaucracy can move like an elephant. It is powerful, but very large, and so you can reasonably predict where it's going and be sure not to be underfoot. Our goal is to work in a more nimble, speedy fashion, which means with more help from our partners. I used to ask audiences, would you rather spend $500 million on the largest U.S. embassy in the world in a place like Baghdad, or would you rather spend $500 million to train 500 Americans, 1 million for each of them, so they would be capable of working in a place like Baghdad? How many of you would favor the embassy? So we pretty much agree, almost unanimously. But I've got bad news for you. Since I started asking this question, they built the embassy. It costs a lot more than $500 million, and we're trying to figure out what to do with it. So we've got to find a way to do things differently. Violent conflict has unofficially dominated U.S. foreign policy for years. So we need to expand the community of people who recognize its centrality and can address it head on. There's a lot of room for improvement, and I hope that we can join in doing that together. I want to take a moment now to address the tension that we sometimes feel when non-governmental groups and governments find themselves in the same space. The U.S. has its national interests at heart, and NGOs often strive for neutrality, and those are not always the same thing. I think the key is to be very honest about when our interests are in sync and when we might need a little space. We should feel like we can help each other, but also keep our distance when necessary without it being a snub. Good, open communications should make that possible. With that, I want to offer you a challenge. When I was at CSIS and we went out to measure progress in Afghanistan, for the first time, almost everyone I spoke to was telling us how that what they were doing was working while the larger enterprise was not going well. So we had a situation where we heard 100 success stories that somehow added up to one very questionable larger effort. There's no mathematical equation that allows 100 pluses to equal a negative. Of course, almost everybody had an explanation, but it completely reinforced the flaws in the approach that we take to these places. So here are some questions that I wonder if you're asking yourselves. Are you working in places that really matter? Even though it's impossible to be transformative, is the larger situation getting any better as a result of your involvement? Even if you're doing brilliant work, what's happening on the broader scale? Asking these questions is part of our goal, and I hope part of yours. We're looking at the next dramatic event and how the United States can be a more intelligent responder, an anticipator, an intervener, and catalytic force. These are the questions of our time. In this space, we see these questions in their rawest form. People are actually killing each other because they can't figure it out. And there's nothing more profound in human life than people killing each other because they can't figure it out. So we're in the most fascinating, most delicate, most demanding, most responsible moment imaginable. And we're trying to say, is there some way the United States can help so it doesn't lead to something more much more tragic? We need your help. If you ever hear me say we're on top of this, we've got it under control, give me a call or send me an email, because we need all the help we can get. There is plenty to be done. We need to keep building the momentum for this work in Congress, elsewhere in the government, and with our partners of all stripes. We need to expand the base of people who believe in this work. And as I said, it can't be business as usual. Thank you very much.
Offered to take some questions if there are questions from the audience. I do have to ask a question myself. Will somebody be handing around the microphones, or do people go to the side?
Handing them out.
Please raise your hand so that the handers out can see you, and stand up and introduce yourself. There's a question down here.
I'm Bob Berg, a proud member of the board of the Alliance. I'm wondering, you know, in this more complicated world we're in, we'll want a lot of company on the journeys that you have mentioned internationally. That is, the questions you've raised we'll want asked within a lot of governments. And I'm wondering, in your initial soundings with counterparts in other governments, and NATO and so forth, your questions are resonating well.
Thanks, Bob. Yes. I've always wanted to give at least one Mike Mansfield answer. In my, as you all know, I'm more likely to go on than to be as succinct as he was, but I still admire his skill. The answer is yes. I mean, whether we're talking to the combatant command leaders here in the U.S. government, or the U.K. government, or even the colleagues that I had a chance to work with when I was at USUN in New York. I think there's a great recognition that we've really got to go at this in a much more creative fashion. And one of the things that I noticed, having worked on this for about 20 years and maybe 30 or plus places now, is that most of us tend to be influenced by our most recent experience. And I think that puts us at risk in this country, because our most recent experience is such a huge one in Iraq and Afghanistan. And yet, I think, as Dick suggested, that this next round of conflicts that we're looking at really have a very different flavor, and different also from what we saw in the 1980s, where many, many of us were mostly shaped by Bosnia, although there were obviously other catastrophes going on. So I think that part of it is just to make sure that we're accumulating this knowledge rather than thinking we've actually got it. And there's, for me, one of the things that's been most fascinating is that is that I never know where I'm going to get the parallel experience. I was surprised to find in the Congo that there was a little more of Haiti than I'd expected, and in Angola there was more of Serbia than I would have thought. And now, why would the, but normally we would put kind of regional experts or so it's part of what we want to do is to have an intellectually challenging enough environment that there's a creative tension within the State Department, and so we don't end up rushing to a consensus view within the U.S. government that this is the way to do something, but really make it a more rigorous test. And that involves kind of a give and take with regional bureaus in particular that's going to have to be more dynamic than it probably has been in some time. And that's one of our significant challenges. But the other thing I would say about these counterparts in other governments, just getting more specifically to your question, is that we're still all relatively small boutiques, and we're still all kind of finding our space within our larger bureaucracies. And so we have to come together. When I was working at OTI, I always used to say, it's nice for us to be doing what we're doing, but we can't be a professional team that just practices all the time. We have to be in a league. You have to have people that you can go out and so competition and creative tension should be part of this model. And so that's why you almost never hear me use the word coordination, although I believe that we really have to work as well together as a fine textile.
Do you want to take your own question?
I can probably see there. It's nice to have fabulous help for anything, for that matter. Let me go back here by the microphone. This gentleman back there, yes.
Thank you. I'm Christos Kyrou from American University and the Center for International Relations. I am from Greece, actually, and I found myself working on this report that I wasn't expecting in my lifetime to do. It has to do with the Greece as a failed state and the liability in terms of regional security in case that Greece becomes a failed state. So the question that I have is, how many steps ahead can USIP be around the world in cases like Greece and others that are not there yet, but they are close to becoming so? So considering the limited capacities in terms of money and resources, how many steps can USIP be before things get bad?
Fortunately, we have. I can answer for CSO and then say that we have partners like USIP that can probably get out ahead of us even farther in some of these cases. And I would hope that many of you would be well ahead of us, because that would give me some greater sense of confidence that we're on top of this. One of the things that worries me is that I'm quite sure that in some cases, in some places, I don't think this is true in the case of Greece, but the U.S. military oftentimes has war plans for all manner of places on Earth. And it strikes me as a minimum requirement that we should have comparable civilian thinking. And the fact that we don't, I think, would shock many taxpayers. So all of us need to do that kind of forward thinking. And it doesn't matter who gets to write the first op-ed piece or draw our attention to it. For any of us who spent any time in Bosnia, the trip from Zurich to Zagreb, that 1.5-hour flight seemed like a pretty sudden way to go from Europe, heaven in Europe, to hell. And it certainly gave me that very raw introduction to the very front end that never be arrogant about what you have. So we should be anxious about these places, because a little anxiety is what prevents disasters. So since most of you are in the prevention business, I mean, you recognize that it's not a great feeling. I mean, worrying about stuff doesn't make you feel great, but it's better to be worried about it than to see the eventuality. So I think that places like Greece we should be alert to. Probably for CSO, our focus is going to be in three kinds of cases: hotspots, too big to fail, and long-standing conflicts that don't seem to be breaking loose. And you can see what kinds of places fall in each of those. But then what we do in each of those might be very different. We might have a full-scale operation and implementation and really be trying to push the U.S. government to make sure that the assistance there is focused. And in another place, we might just be doing advanced strategic planning or advising an embassy even. And that's certainly the model that we've been building upon. This woman right here.
Thank you very much. My name is Mindy Reiser. I'm representing Global Peace Services USA. A question about the richness of the U.S. government and those parts of it that may not have been involved in collaboration. The Peace Corps has its own identity and is at a distance from intelligence gathering, but certainly the people on the ground have such insight and such commitment to the well-being of their countries. Is there any way their insights can be fed into this process? And also the Fulbright program, there are now many people from all parts of the world who are in the United States and Americans overseas. They have insights, they have worlds, they have knowledge of that others don't. Is there a way to tap into this extraordinary intellectual resource?
Sure. And I think an awful lot of the processes that I've seen at CSO invite that kind of broader participation. But part of it is to differentiate between sort of formal sharing of information and informal. My feeling always when I was at OTI was that everything we were doing was basically in an overt space. And being in an overt space meant that we were transparent about the information we were collecting, so we should be sharing it with anybody. And if the intelligence community or whoever else wanted to know what we were thinking, that was fine because it was public information. And I feel that that's one way to get around this sort of worry that people have about their insights being misused by the official world. Is what I do is open, and so I'm sharing it with anybody who has an interest in this, in promoting peace in the place. And I think that's probably the easier formula for people like the Peace Corps, rather than they're being seen as information gatherers for the U.S. policy apparatus. On the other hand, one of my favorite sayings ever was a retired intelligence officer who was living in Princeton when I was teaching there, and he stood up one day and he said, I found after I retired that I had an advantage that none of my former colleagues had. I had open and free access to open information. And I think actually it's interesting now. We get some analysis data from the intelligence community that's actually based on totally available information. So they saw that as a weakness in their own work, and it's actually been it's quite helpful to have them collect it. I think this woman right here.
One more question.
Right, maybe this woman right here. Sorry for missing the rest of you, but.
Thank you. My name is Beatrice Camp. I'm a State Department Foreign Service Officer on detail to the Smithsonian.
I'm sorry, doing what?
On detail to the Smithsonian.
Oh, great.
And thanks. I wanted to ask whether there's any part of your office that's working on cultural recovery issues. Smithsonian did a lot of work in Haiti after the earthquake. But in addition, I was thinking we had a briefing and discussion yesterday with Ambassador Derek Mitchell about what the Smithsonian is doing in Burma, the kind of environmental and conservation research there, which is really, for the last 20 years, has been building a foundation that can be very helpful now. Sure. But particularly on the sort of cultural artifacts, the Baghdad Museum kind of issue, is there anybody in your office in the Bureau who's looking at that kind of issue? Thank you.
The answer is not specifically no, but what I would like to be able to say, and I think we're working on, is to really understand these cases, you better not approach them as from just a political optic or an economics optic or an anthropological optic. By the way, I met more anthropologists in Haiti when I was working there in the 90s than any other place on Earth. Or as a sociologist, that it's really when you get this convergence of violence in a society, when it breaks down this badly, it's usually a witch's brew. And to understand it, you've got to have all of those disciplines at play. And so that's part of what we're trying to build at CSO, and I hope that our talent, to be respected and trusted, is going to have that kind of breadth of understanding. Whether the cultural issue would rise to be one of the two or three top priorities in a place is difficult to say, but it's possible, and it shouldn't be excluded any more than it should be the sort of the default position that we take. So I'm really hoping that we'll have the freshness of analysis that will be sensitive to those kinds of opportunities, but not be a captive of anyone when it gets there. Well, thank you all very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. You've given us a lot of challenges, but you've also indicated where we can work to support you. So great. Thank you very much.
You. Thanks. Okay. Appreciate it.
And I'm now turning the podium back to Melanie.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Barton, and thank you for your excellent questions. Well, as you know, peacebuilding works on flexible time. So we are a little bit over, but we've built extra time into our breaks and into lunch. So we will continue now with our full substantive program. And I'm delighted to move into our next phase. About a year ago, Chick Dombach was speaking with people at USIP about the question which a lot of us spend a lot of time talking about at cocktail parties and in our own gatherings. What is peacebuilding? What is the field? Are we a field? And Chick and USIP decided to go down a path to create a report that would try to answer some of the questions about what are some of the demographics and key principles of our work. So fast forward a year later, on June 15th, we will have a report coming out that's looking specifically at a map of the peacebuilding field. We've been extremely fortunate to work in this venture with the Institute for Peacebuilding and Justice at the University of San Diego. They conducted the surveys and did the main academic research for what's turning out to be a very, very rich and interesting study. So this morning, you'll all be getting a sneak preview. Neshla Chirgi and Elena McCollum will be presenting the data. I'll talk a little bit about some of the implications for our field, and Jeff Helsing from USIP will give an academic and professional assessment of his views of some of this work. So with no further ado, I'll turn this over to Elena. To Neshla, who will be starting. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I must say that first session was really very rich and set the wonderful stage for what follows. Our presentation is going to be much more focused. The first session dealt with managing complexity, and we're going to focus on peacebuilding, and especially the peacebuilding community. On behalf of our research team at the Institute for Peace and Justice at the University of San Diego, I would first like to thank USIP and the Alliance for Peacebuilding for giving us the opportunity to collaborate with them on the Peacebuilding Mapping Project. We're also grateful to the Institute's director, Milburn Line, who's here with us, and the steering committee of the project, Rob Risigliano, Joyce New, Ida Breuer, and Hratch Gregorian, for their support and guidance. It has been a wonderfully rich learning experience for all of us, and we're excited to share some of the highlights of the project with you at AFP's annual meeting, which has imaginatively been called Peacebuilding 2.0. Indeed, we're entering into a qualitatively different phase of peacebuilding for all the reasons that we heard earlier. For many of us in this room who have been grappling with this complex and elusive concept called peacebuilding, it's time to take stock of how far we have come in the last couple of decades, and then to recommit ourselves to the tasks that lie ahead. It was at another meeting of peace builders that Peter Wallenstein reminded us exactly how far we have come. He said, "Today, when we talk of SSR and DDR, we no longer remember that those acronyms stood for the Soviet Socialist Republic and the Deutsche Demokratische Republik." Indeed, recently when I ask my graduate students to define SSR and DDR, they automatically talk about security sector reform, disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration of former combatants. They have no other reference point. Yet, just think back to the days before 1990. Who would have imagined that we would be talking about a new deal for international engagement with fragile states, or the QDDR, or the UN's Peacebuilding Commission, or R2P, or the Atrocities Prevention Board? But yesterday, those were precisely the topics at the first day of our meeting at the Woodrow Wilson Center. When it was launched in the early 1990s, Peacebuilding 1.0 was a totally new notion. During the Cold War, very few of us called ourselves peacebuilders. We were humanitarians, conflict resolution practitioners, or development professionals. We did not do peace. There was a totally different peace and security architecture composed of militaries, diplomats, and security experts. They did peace. But once the Cold War ended, it became possible to see the peace that to see that peace was more than the prevention of an all-out war among two heavily armed superpower blocs and the preservation of a state-based international order. Peace meant human security, refugees who could go home, children who were not abducted to become killers, communities that were not terrorized by their own governments, and natural resources that were not looted by greedy warlords. And most of all, peace was the opportunity to live without fear, without want, and with dignity. Thus, the 1990s saw the emergence of a different world as peace building gradually took shape, interlinking with peacemaking, peacekeeping, human rights, humanitarian affairs, and development. In retrospect, peace building 1.0 was an incredibly heady and audacious enterprise. Let's quickly remember its major achievements. The 1990s saw the evolution of a new global normative order in human rights, democracy, human security, protection of civilians, the responsibility to protect, and the International Criminal Court. It also saw the emergence of new actors and new institutional arrangements as the global civil society and even the private sector got involved in issues of peace and security. Concurrently, there were a number of new units in bilateral and multilateral development agencies dedicated to conflict prevention and post-conflict peace building. And that's when Ambassador Barton and we first met, when he was at the OTI. Eventually, the UN created its new peacebuilding architecture, comprised of the Peacebuilding Commission, Peacebuilding Fund, and the Peacebuilding Support Office. Donor governments and multilateral organizations set up new funding mechanisms for peacebuilding. Many NGOs became actively engaged in peacebuilding in such diverse areas as peace and conflict impact assessment, rule of law, transitional justice, community-based policing, and even prison reform. Governments and international organizations adopted new policies and procedures to address the challenges of conflict-prone, conflict-torn, or post-conflict countries. All this was accompanied by a growing knowledge base as peace-building research grew in leaps and bounds. Yet, with this dizzying level of activity and experimentation came many sobering questions. What is this thing called peace-building? Whose responsibility is it? How has it changed the way that international actors conduct their work in conflict-affected countries? How has the multitude of initiatives, activities, norms, policies, mechanisms actually contributed to peace-building in concrete contexts? And even more profoundly, with the radical change in the international environment after 9/11, and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, what does peace-building mean today as state-centric security concerns have once again gained predominance? There are no easy answers to these questions, yet unless we grapple with them seriously, peace-building risks being left behind as new agendas and priorities inevitably come to the fore. The peace-building enterprise has come a long way, but it has to constantly renew itself to address new forms of political conflict, violent crime, terrorism, and other threats to human security. And it has to demonstrate that the peace-building approach makes a difference, thus the need for peace-building 2.0. But if the peace-building community is to play a larger role in supporting peace and human security, we need to have a much better understanding of its profile, its working methods, its principles, and its contributions. Indeed, there has been a tremendous proliferation of research, analysis, evaluation, and reassessment of the peace-building enterprise in the last few years. Curiously, despite its many achievements, it's still quite difficult to define peacebuilding and to identify its scope, boundaries, and central tendencies. As a result, peacebuilding remains a rather amorphous concept, meaning many things to many people with very different agendas. Equally seriously, it risks becoming a collection of discrete activities, initiatives, programs, and projects which are not necessarily pulling in the same direction. And I think Ambassador Barton made this point very eloquently. Now, the peace-building mapping project emerged out of a desire to gain a better understanding of the U.S.-based non-governmental peace-building community. The project had three goals: to develop a description of peace building in order to define the field's scope and parameters, to produce a census and inventory, again, of US-based non-governmental organizations that fall within those parameters, and then finally, to publish a report providing useful insights and practical recommendations to strengthen peace building as a field of policy and practice. Interestingly, in designing the project, it quickly became clear that finding a definition that would encompass the range of organizations working in peace building would be extremely problematic, since there is no universally accepted definition of peace building to determine who is in and who's out. Thus, instead of a deductive approach, the project adopted an inductive approach to define the field. Peacebuilding would be defined on the basis of what peacebuilders do. But that posed another interesting question: who are the peacebuilders? Naturally, we started with a survey of all the US-based organizational members of the Alliance for Peacebuilding. 44 out of the 66 members responded to the survey. The survey provided interesting information about the organizational profile and peacebuilding approaches of the Alliance's members. But we knew that this was only a small part of a much larger community of practice. Thus, we decided to expand the pool to a larger community of NGOs. Deciding who to include in the second survey was not an easy task either. Having already surveyed the Alliance's own constituency, we knew that they were a fairly diverse group, including conflict resolution NGOs, academic institutions, humanitarian and development organizations representing many sectors. Accordingly, we selected 20 key sectors and sent a second and a much simpler questionnaire to some 250 US-based organizations. We received 75 responses. We then analyzed the profile of the two survey respondents, which my colleague Elena McCullum will momentarily present. Interestingly, the great majority of the second survey respondents clearly indicated that they also considered themselves as peace builders. But like the members of the Alliance for Peacebuilding, there were big differences among them in terms of their sectors of work, working methods, approaches, and partnerships. The reality is that we now have a more differentiated understanding of the richness and diversity of the US-based peacebuilding community. But we're not much closer to describing how this community is networked and how their efforts can best be joined for greater impact. Our surveys have identified a fairly broad range of organizations that consider their work to be peacebuilding. But there are no firm or obvious tasks, principles, approaches, and strategies that bring the community together. Instead, we see a set of concentric circles, sectors, which can best be represented in a Venn diagram. As my colleague Elena will demonstrate, peacebuilding is in fact seen and practiced simultaneously as a sector of work, a profession, and a lens. This, of course, has multiple implications for Peacebuilding 2.0, which Melanie Greenberg will address. In conclusion, let me quickly say that we see the Peacebuilding Mapping Project as a first systematic attempt to describe a segment of the US-based peacebuilding community. The project was neither exhaustive nor comprehensive. However, knowing what we know now, we feel that we can significantly broaden and deepen our investigation. The formal report of the project will be circulated shortly. In the meantime, we will continue to mine and interpret the rich data we have gathered. The survey results will be available for others who might also be interested in reviewing them. We also hope to continue working with the Alliance for Peacebuilding and others to ensure that peacebuilding steadily becomes a stronger and a more coherent community which can offer a common vision and identifiable sets of skills, approaches, principles, and values for making the world a safer and more secure place. Instead of Klaus Witz's aphorism that war is the pursuit of politics by other means, we need to demonstrate that peacebuilding is the only alternative to war in pursuit of politics. Over to you, Elena.
Thanks very much indeed, Nejla. I'd like to also acknowledge our colleague, Jill Covert, who contributed mightily to the production of this report, as well, of course, as Melanie and her wonderful team at the AFP, the Alliance for Peace Building, and, of course, the United States Institute of Peace. Well, I can begin by reiterating what Nejla explained towards the end of her presentation, which is that we'd like to make clear at the outset that the study was conducted in two phases. We're very pleased to be able to report these preliminary findings. First, a survey was administered to the Alliance for Peace Building members. Then a second survey was administered to a larger community comprised of those organizations named by AFP members as key partners in their peace building work, supplemented by organizations selected by the research team with an eye to reaching as broad a grouping of organizations from related sectors as possible. It's not advancing. There may be a delay as well. I could speak from the notes. No. Yeah. No. The perversity of inanimate objects. It ran perfectly this morning, but inevitably there's a slip betwixt cup and lip, and so maybe the closing of the laptop introduced a little glitch. Starting? It seems to be a mere matter of restarting the program, so we'll beg your indulgence for a few moments more. Thank you.
a problem.
All right. Thank you very much. Where would we be without technical assistance, right? Very good. So to pick up the thread, I just began to describe what Nejla had described at the end of her presentation about the first survey that was administered to the Alliance for Peacebuilding members, the second survey that was administered to a broader grouping. We'll call it here for shorthand related sectors. And then we saw that it bifurcated into two groups, which we're calling, for brevity's sake, subgroup one and subgroup two, again, as you heard Nejla say. And I'll say a little bit more about the point at which we separated them out when I come to that point in the presentation. So I hope you'll bear with me and be able to follow the different subgroups, and forgive me if I keep renaming them, just so that we can keep hold of the thread as we go. All right, so first, Survey 1, the Alliance for Peacebuilding members. We are very grateful indeed that so many of the members responded. I won't refer to this group as the respondents, although that technically that's what they are, but as the members for shorthand, since it comprised the majority of the members. I will talk first about their organizational profile, then their areas of substantive focus, the content analysis that we performed of the mission statements, definitions of peacebuilding, key features of peacebuilding, partnerships and challenges to effective peacebuilding named by the members. They are mainly academic and research institutions, development NGOs, some of which are faith-based NGOs, alliances and consortia of practitioners, and for-profit conflict resolution consultants. 79% were established after 1990, a significant proportion, obviously. And the majority report that their mission has not changed in the last 10 years. Financial resources are extremely limited, with over 60% reporting an annual budget of under $500,000 and 25% at under $90,000. Largely privately funded by individual donors, 70% of them, private foundations, 57%, and less than half other. Various sources such as fees for services and publications, and of course, government support as well. Estimated total resources, we accepted the top three because they were such outliers. So the cumulative figure for all except the top three came to an estimated $52 million. Of the top three, one was had an annual budget of over $10 million, and two had budgets each of over $50 million. Nonetheless, even assuming budgets in the hundreds of millions for the top two each, compare this with the cumulative figure for international development NGOs of $13 billion. That's billion with a B. This pie chart summarizes the financial information that I just gave. And not surprisingly, these organizations function heroically with small staffs generally. 75% have 25 or fewer staff members. Although at one end of the spectrum, one did report over 5,400 full-time employees. And again, heroically, they work in 153 countries. Africa is the continent with the largest number of organizations. And they work pretty much across the conflict continuum, as we might term it. And you can see the figures there, 69.8% before conflict, 74.4% during conflict, and 93% in the post-conflict. Although, as we have been hearing throughout the course of this conference, the distinction between those three phases begins to seem less and less significant in this context of complexity that we are grappling with today. Now, a few words about the areas of substantive focus. I don't know whether you can read the chart, and I won't ask or expect you to. What I want you to mainly take away from this image, is this idea of three main tiers. It basically seems to break out into three main tiers, does it not? And so the top three areas named as areas of substantive focus by the members were very top, peacebuilding at 86%, followed by conflict analysis and management at 81%, and civil society promotion at 74%. Then, as you can see, there is a fairly significant drop down to governance and democracy support, named by 49%, then women and gender, named by 44%, and then at 37 each, we have development, environment, human rights, transitional justice, and youth and children. Then came research and policy advocacy at 33% and security sector reform, SSR, at 28%. After that, we see a bit more of a drop. You can see that last year, it ranges from 21% down to 9%, and the scope is quite broad, ranging from rule of law to health to agriculture and rural development, private sector development, microenterprise, water and sanitation, and media promotion are some selected ones. Now, the research team performed a content analysis of the mission statements provided by the members. 30% of the Alliance for Peacebuilding members were found to have used one or more of the following terms in their mission statements: conflict resolution, mediation, dialogue, and negotiation. What we think of as the very stuff of traditional, the very essence of traditional conflict resolution work. Definitions of peacebuilding were, as Nejla has indicated to us, hard to come by. Half reported that they do not subscribe to an explicit definition. Many responded in the qualitative data that peacebuilding really needs to be defined within the context. And so there was a great reluctance to provide a consensus definition, if you will, that could be applied broadly. It seemed that respondents generally equated peacebuilding with their own area of work. They were also asked to characterize the key features of peacebuilding. 93% cited building trust. Social cohesion was cited by 91%, nonviolence by 77%, and you can see the other ones were high as well: political participation, human development, and peace with justice. As to challenges facing the peace-building field, as identified by this group, inadequate financial resources came in at the top at 81%, and then lack of political will internationally at 61%. Followed by weak peace-building infrastructure at 58%, the domestic political environment at 51%, and operational and implementation challenges at 40%. Diversity and number of conflicts requiring attention came in at 37%. You'll find notably that this was cited at a higher rate in the next group. Human resources only came in at 35%. Maybe showing very strong will on the part of the respondents. The respondents, the members, were also asked the question, please name up to 5 organizations that you consider to be key partners in your peace-building work. Now, of course, not all listed 5, some listed fewer, and indeed not all responded to the question at all. So, when we took out the duplicates, we came with a cumulative figure of 39 different organizations, also excluding governmental organizations. So 16 were academic institutions or think tanks, or one might say think and do tanks, 11 development NGOs, 4 that might be classified as civic associations or educational NGOs, 4 advocacy organizations, 2 funders, and 2 unclassified. Now, I mentioned that the second survey divided out into 2 subgroups. We collected organizational data for all, and that data will be presented in the aggregate. So you can see that in the top circle. And then we'll talk about, for subgroup 1 and subgroup 2 each, their different responses to the questions about sectors, strategies, approaches, partnerships, and challenges. These are largely academic institutions, followed by NGOs, faith-based NGOs, 16%, 13% advocacy organizations, and 69% were founded during the ending decade of the Cold War in the 1980s and after. So as you can see, this is an older and presumably somewhat more established group as a whole than the first group. I don't know whether you can see the financial resources there. It's a little bit difficult to read from where I am, but I think it's easier to read where you are. So starting here, 8% had annual budgets of more than 50 million, 15% budgets from 10 to 50 million, 7% budgets from 7 to 10 million, 18% budgets from 1.5 to 5 million, and so forth. I think the rest is easier to read from where you are. So a rather distinct situation. Still, 40% operate on 25 or fewer staff members, with 23 operating on 10 or fewer staff members. As to the geographic regions and context of work, 52% work in East Africa, 49% in the Middle East, North Africa. Obviously, these were not mutually exclusive. 48% reported having more than one office abroad. And again, they worked across what one might term the conflict continuum, although at lower percentages than the Alliance for Peacebuilding members. Now, continuing to the discussion of sectors, first for subgroup one. As Nejla stated, they were asked to choose among 20 sectors, and you can see the sectors listed here. I won't read through them for the sake of time, but the spread is pretty broad, as you can see. So, moving on to subgroup one, by far the larger of the two groups. And again, these are organizations that identified themselves as peace-building organizations. When asked to report the sectors in which they worked, 70% listed peace-building, 61% conflict prevention, 54% women and gender, and then the remainder sectors that were listed were democracy and government, development, human rights, human security, and youth, each at 43%. Likewise, a content analysis of the mission statements was done in terms of the process terms listed before, the conflict resolution, mediation, dialogue, or negotiation terms. And 9% were found to have used one or more of them in their mission statements. Again, compare with 30% for the Alliance for Peacebuilding members. As to strategies of work, they listed at the top capacity building at nearly 61%, networking and alliance building, training, and playing a catalytic or facilitation role. Note that many of these terms could be applied across a range of sectors, not simply or not only and not exclusively conflict resolution or peace building work, but rather these speak to strategies rather than more than perhaps content. When asked to name challenges to peace building, subgroup one listed inadequate financial resources, although not as often, 71% though did list it, and 49%, almost half, listed the diversity, number of, and magnitude of regions and conflicts in which they work, within which they work. This was followed by the foreign government's political and policy environment. Skipping over, you'll see the lack of political will internationally. Inadequate human resources was listed at roughly the same rate as the Alliance for Peacebuilding members. Weak infrastructures and the U.S. political and policy environment came in at only 25%. Now, forgive the reiteration of this slide, but it's to remind us to help us hang on to the thread, if you will, the clue through the labyrinth, almost. We are to the last subgroup, and that's subgroup two. So regarding their sector strategies, approaches, partnerships, and challenges, the sector that they listed at the top was development. 47% of them work in international development. 40% work in health. 40% work in human rights. 33% in women and gender, 33% in youth, followed by academic work, democracy and governance, and the environment, then by human security, peace building, security, and finally the last few tiers, conflict prevention, genocide prevention, humanitarian aid, hunger, and the rule of law, with just a very few, one each, in fact, in nuclear proliferation, refugees and internally displaced persons, religion, and science and technology. However, the strategies of work were remarkably similar, capacity building at 60%, networking and alliance building likewise, training and the catalytic or facilitation role. Again, this is a small sample size, so we do want to put out that caveat, but we thought it was particularly intriguing because, again, this was the group that, although they self-identified as not a peace-building organization. When posed the question, would you call yourself a peace-building organization, they said no. But when asked, do you implement peace-building programs and projects, they said yes. And so this seemed to our team a very interesting clue and area for possible future research. So just a couple of concluding observations. AFP members use a diverse set of tools, approaches, and strategies. 30% of them are involved in traditional conflict resolution. Of course, the remaining 70% are spread across a number of different sectors. Now, as to subgroup one, the larger of the subgroups in the second survey, again, organizations from a broad variety of sectors that are nonetheless related to conflict resolution and who identify themselves as peace-building organizations. They are spread out across diverse sectors. They are focused on peace-building, yes, 70% of them cited it, and conflict prevention, 61%, but less so on the areas reflected in the four process terms, conflict resolution, mediation, negotiation, dialogue. So again, I would like to reiterate what Nejla was telling us in her concluding remarks. The community of peace building has expanded vastly in a comparatively short period of time. It continues to be viewed variously as a profession, a sector, and a lens for work that will influence work in other areas, and that does, in fact, shape work in other areas. So we need to better exploit and hopefully exploit these linkages, explore and exploit them, and ideally through some kind of network, social network analysis that can help us get a sense of the density of networking that exists among them, the density or the lack thereof. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Nejla and Elena. I think you can all see why it has been such a rich experience and such a pleasure to work with the team at the Institute for Peace and Justice in San Diego. I want to thank Nejla and Elena and Milburn, who is here, and Jill, who is not. It's been a venture with the highest level of academic integrity, creativity, professionalization. I feel very fortunate that they've been our partners. And also to work with Emily Malozzi and Sarah Sechvala here at AFP as we've been doing our bi-coastal data analysis and implications research. It's been a wonderful project. One of the most exciting elements for me of this project has been thinking about the implications of this data for our field. And I want to make clear that we don't see this as our own unilateral set of findings. We would love to discuss with you in the time between now and the report is published, and even after it's published, to get your view on what we can do as a field to unite our principles, to work across different sectors, and to really bring this data to life. As Nejla mentioned, the definitional question has been very challenging. If you have two people in a room discussing this, you'll have three different definitions of peace building. They tend to be many layered, with references both to modes of practice, for example, negotiation or mediation, but also principles of neutrality or do no harm. You often hear people talking about working in and around conflict, so that can be anything that happens in a conflict zone to alleviate suffering or build new institutions for peace and stability. And you sometimes have people saying it's very restricted. People only working on the conflict can be defined as peace builders. Our findings that there's something in between. We found we were batting around many metaphors. We're like ripples in a pond with a core of peace building and building outwards. We're a Venn diagram. And it's been great fun trying to think about how do we visualize the definitions. It's also been interesting trying to find what the lines are between our fields of practice, even within related sectors, and as we tried to find very concrete examples of what is peace building and what isn't. So, for example, among experts who deal with election violence, I think it's very clear that peace building would be the people who try to focus election processes in a way that elections won't be a nexus for violence, as in Kenya, but could be opportunities for reimagining a peaceful future. We probably wouldn't say, though, that people who are developing more technically precise ballot machines are necessarily doing peace building, but you might argue with that. Or in the development field, water experts who are working with villagers about where to place the well so that if there is an ethnic or tribal dispute, you're not wandering into enemy territory to get your water. That's probably peace building. But would the sanitation experts working on delivering clean water be peace builders? These are the kinds of questions we've looked at. But one thing that's very clear is that we need to embrace a larger community of practice to amplify the strength of peace building. There are currently very deep silos between related fields, between democracy, development, health, human rights. We don't talk to each other. We don't do collaborative processes. There are many organizations that need some economy of scale. As you saw from those shocking financial numbers, we are a tiny, tiny fraction of the entire ecology of groups that are working in and around conflict. As we know from the congressional budget disputes, USIP's entire budget of $37 million finances about 4 hours of the war in Afghanistan. So we need to do all that we can to unite our fragmented communities, to create a voice for peace in Congress and with other sources of funding, to bring the resources to this field that we need to do the work that we do. We need more collaboration and systemic thinking that will lead to more effective collaboration and impact. We need to join each other's organizations and learn to speak each other's language. That we go to the interaction meetings, which is a development field, we need to be going to the democracy field, to the health, the human rights field, to the health fields, and get to know them, get to interact with them professionally, so we have contacts and we're actually working in conflict zones. But it's not enough just to think about our professional interactions. We need a real realignment in the intellectual approach to peace building. One of the things that we need to do to move to peace building 2.0 is a more systemic view of peace building, to have a systems approach, not only to look at the little micro processes that we're all involved in, but to think about how they add up to something like peace writ large, that the sum is greater than our parts. And in a shameless plug for intellectual capital in this field, I recommend Rob Pisigliano's new book, Making Peace Last. Copies are available outside. There's a website, Facebook page. But it's a very thoughtful analysis of how we move from this micro-level thinking to a collaborative, whole-of-community approach, not only in practice, but in the very way we think about systems of conflict and where we can intervene most effectively. One of the most intriguing findings to come out of the data was not only peacebuilding as a profession, but as a lens. And a lens for peacebuilding means conflict-sensitive approaches. Every action within a fragile, chaotic environment can serve to either reduce or, in some cases, to augment conflict, often in ways that are very difficult to ascertain in advance. Decisions about where to place water wells, what textbooks to use in schools, where to house health clinics, how to introduce microfinance to women, all have the potential either to fan the flames of violence or to help quell potential conflict. Increasingly, even organizations that do not consider themselves peace builders do understand this conflict lens and attempt to carry out their work in ways that will, at worst, not aggravate conflict. And I think there's an interesting analogy here to the Green Movement, that the environmental movement began with core activists and scientists working to develop new models of sustainability and advocating for legislative change, very much where we are now in the peacebuilding field. But the environmental field has expanded to such a degree that green practices are now woven into the fabric of innumerable areas of life and commerce. And we anticipate that peacebuilding will become that kind of lens in the next 20 years. So not only a professional development and increase, but also an intellectual, forceful, philosophical adjustment that can go into a range of different sectors. And finally, I'd like to talk about implications for education. I'm struck wherever I go, whether teaching my own classes, working with some of our younger members, about the passion for peacebuilding among younger people, many of whom were born after September 11th and have a desire, there's a Hebrew word, tikkun olam, to heal the world. But our educational system is burgeoning now with peace studies programs, peace building programs. Here at George Mason University, there's now a school for conflict analysis and resolution that grants degrees, master's, PhDs in peace building. But the field has not advanced to the point where we have enough career slots for all of these students who are graduating with such passion. And one of the implications that comes out of our research is you can have a grounding in peace-building skills, but you might not hang a shingle and become a mediator or join Partners for Democratic Change or Search for Common Ground. You might go to work for World Vision. You might become a development expert or a health expert. You might work in one of these other sectors related to peace building and use the skills that you've learned in your degree. So I think we need to change the dialogue about what we expect our students to do once they leave their schooling and enter the field. And I think we have a responsibility to do that. So we hope that we'll develop many other implications. Those are a few of our starting thoughts. We really welcome hearing from you. I will turn the mic over to Jeff Helsing from USIP. We are going to end by about 11:30. We'll take a quick 10-minute break. And I recommend, because I know that all of you will want to talk more about this, that over lunch we have a table set up where you can all talk with us, talk with our researchers, and give us your own ideas. So thank you. Jeff.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me? I am actually mic'd up, so I'm not going to move. Much of what Melanie said certainly reflects my response to this this survey. I remember long ago when I first was at the Institute and would talk to audiences about peace building. And it was a much narrower field 15 years ago. But one of the things that I think is still very true and is reflected in what we've just seen is that if you're in the peace building field, you have to be comfortable with ambiguity and the lack of definitions. And secondly, you have to be comfortable being in a field and doing work that is continually evolving. And as a result, I'm not too concerned about the fact that there's not yet a definition or there's not agreement on a definition of what peace building is, because if we're talking about peace building 2.0, then in a way, we are continuing to create the definition. We are defining the field as we go forward, as we continue to do the work that we are doing. So what I find much more interesting in a way and much more practical is the focus on the peace-building lens, because it is the lens that we are contributing to the work of other fields and other sectors. What's interesting is the interest of those in the security field, those in the health field, those in the agriculture field in being exposed to that lens, so that the sanitation person actually has some skills, analytical skills, that will enable them to contribute in their sanitation decision to enhancing the broader peace-building agenda in a particular conflict in which many are contributing to developing sustainable peace-building. And I think that's what's really exciting and is reiterated by this particular survey. 15 years ago, those sectors, if you had sort of looked at who really were the sectors of the peace-building field, I dare say it would be a pretty narrow, small group. And that's continuing to expand. What I think is very important is what is it that we in the peace-building community can contribute to the education and training of those in other fields and other sectors. And I think there are different types of skills, different types of ways of helping to develop and expand and really make more applicable this lens that we're talking about. So there are certain basic principles that have been discussed this morning, from Rick Barton to some of the things that have been discussed with the survey, such things as capacity building and eliciting, developing the skills to elicit from locals what their needs and interests are. transparency, that is, working in a transparent way, being able to work across sectors, being able to value contributions of others because they bring a different and important perspective or different important skills, but also some basic conflict resolution skills, negotiation skills, communication skills. All of those things are important aspects of what we can contribute to those in the health field or development or those who are working at the religious sector, et cetera. So I think that what this does is really validate the work that we are doing across sectors, across disciplines, and bringing in more organizations and disciplines into what really is, a communal contribution to building sustainable peace, which, after all, is really the core element of what it is we're trying to do. And I see that we have a little less than 10 minutes, so I will stop there and at least give some people opportunities to ask questions, particularly about the survey. Yes.
I appreciate that, Jeff. I think we actually need to move from flexible peacebuilding time to precise military time, since we do have a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense joining us in the next panel, which is supposed to start now. What I'd recommend is that we hold questions, and for that I apologize. Take a 10-minute break, go to the restroom, we have refreshments, and then gather back here. We'll sign a chime to begin our next panel. But I do encourage all of you to talk with us. We want to hear your views. Thank you very much, Nejla, Elena, and Jeff.
the left side.
Okay. I'm going to have...
I'm a little, you know, it's not good for my back.
You? Can you see how my order I've got here? I've got Bernard.
Huge news.
Should I tell everybody?
Oh, congratulations, my friend.
Yeah. They got lucky getting you at college. Really, really happy about that. So I got to catch up with you before you move out of here.
Well, I'll be around through the end of the month. And I can...
I've told them all about how we need to enlist your,
well, that's great.
Your smarts. Must be comfortable. Did you want to give lunch instructions? All right, I think we want to try to catch up on time a little bit. So folks want to get in. Can somebody rouse people outside there for one last? Yeah, thanks, Melanie. The other Melanie. Two minutes, folks. People are streaming back in. You know, if we just told people that lunch was being served in here, we would have taken care of everything. Okay, great. Come on in, take a seat. We'll get started. Good morning. I got 15 minutes and we're still morning. Good morning, everybody. My name is Sheldon Himmelfarb, believe it or not, and I manage USIP's Center of Innovation on Science, Technology, and Peacebuilding. And despite being in this dangerous place between you and lunch, I've really been looking forward to this session for lots of reasons. First, I think this is going to really get us thinking about the 2.0 part of peacebuilding 2.0, in the sense that we're going to be looking beyond our own field for insights that might help us to do things in a new, different, and hopefully better way. Secondly, we've just got such an interesting and diverse group of panelists to help us do that, an ecologist, a genomicist, an engineer, a DoD strategist, and me, a recovering consultant. Now I think I know what Einstein's chauffeur felt like with this group. So I'm going to introduce this distinguished group in just a minute. But first, let me set up the discussion very quickly by just quoting from one of the great pioneers and founding fathers of our field, John Paul Lederach, who once defined the complexity of peacebuilding as multiple actors pursuing a multiplicity of actions and initiatives at numerous levels of social relationships in an interdependent setting at the same time. That really says it all, doesn't it? Echoes of what a lot of people have been saying here this morning, of what Rick Barton was saying, Dick Solomon's remarks about the complexity and the number of actors involved in and the complexity of human social dynamics. Let me read it one more time. Multiple actors pursuing a multiplicity of actions and initiatives at numerous levels of social relationships in an interdependent setting at the same time. So I think that really says it all, why this work is so difficult. Now, time's short. I know we're running a little bit over, so let's see what we can learn from other fields where complexity also abounds, but in different ways. I'm going to introduce each of these panelists briefly, and then I'm going to ask them all to take just a few minutes to give an opening statement. I've asked them to get us started by answering kind of this double-barreled question that I've put before them, which is, how do you think about complexity in your respective fields? And more importantly, how do you think about managing that complexity in ways that achieve, produce good results? And of course, I realize that it is pretty ridiculous to ask people to explain something as complex as complexity in just a couple of minutes, let alone their solutions. But that's what we've got to do because we want to leave plenty of time for you all to ask what's on your mind. We want to ask you to please lean in, write down the questions that you have, take advantage of really this really interesting group of people from a diverse set of fields. Lean in, jot down your questions, and be ready to ask them when I open the floor, which I will kind of try to move us along to the Q&A pretty quickly. So without further ado, let me introduce our speakers. Right here on my left, Bernard Amade, founder of Engineers Without Borders International and founding president of Engineers Without Borders USA. In both cases, the mission of the organization is providing a way for engineers and engineering groups to assist underserved and poor communities in their respective countries around the world. They work in a number of conflict countries, including Afghanistan, Haiti, Israel, Palestine. So he is no stranger to the challenges of peace building. Bernard is also professor of civil engineering at the University of Colorado at Boulder, where he's the faculty director of the Mortensen Center in Engineering for Developing Communities. And to Bernard's left, we have Tim Ellinger. Tim is Associate Professor of Biological Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and a talented ecologist. His research focuses on aquatic ecosystems, and he too has worked in conflict or post-conflict countries. Most recently, for the last couple of years, he's been collaborating with colleagues in the Balkans on sustainable development strategies and environmental governance, and he is currently part of the team creating a new professional Masters of Sustainable Peacebuilding at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Simon Twigger is Assistant Professor of Physiology at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and his research focuses on the intersection of the genome and bioinformatics, which, if I may grossly oversimplify, means he essentially does two things, studies how biological systems work and don't work in order to understand how we can solve diseases. And secondly, building software tools to help the scientific community study genes. And finally, to Simon's left, we've got Daniel. Daniel Chu is the Principal Director of Strategy in the Office of the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy. Prior to joining the Department of Defense, Dr. Chu was a research staff member at the Institute for Defense Analysis, where he served as a study director in the Joint Advanced Warfighting Division. helping joint military force commanders coordinate to develop advanced training, education concepts, innovation, and breakthrough improvements. I like that a lot, breakthrough improvements. We are going to be listening very carefully, Dan, to see how you achieve that. So now join me, please, in welcoming all of our panelists here. All right, I'm going to have a seat here, and I'm going to ask if we start with you, Dan. And
do I have to do anything to get this started? No. Good afternoon, I think, or almost afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much for having me here. In fact, it's a great pleasure. Not only do I hope to learn a lot from this very diverse panel, but hope to convey to you a little bit about what we're doing at the Department of Defense, in particular in terms of long-term planning. That's my office. I'm actually currently now the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Strategy in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and our primary role is doing long-term planning and analysis for the Department of Defense. Let me emphasize a couple of things before I dive into the complexity issue itself. One is, as we think long-term for the Department of Defense, let me make clear, despite some of the perhaps edgy-sounding words in my resume, that one of the key areas we're focused on is conflict prevention. Basically, we understand that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and that our emphasis on looking at how to do conflict prevention, whether it's through fairly traditional approaches like deterrence, whether it's through well-recognized approaches like building partnership capacity, or whether it's through looking at peacekeeping, peace-building types of operations. This is something that the Department of Defense has emphasized very, very strongly in some of our recent strategic guidance documents, including the strategic guidance document that came out earlier this year in January, but also the Quadrennial Defense Review that came out in 2010. And it's something the department basically is learning how to manage. And in fact, this is part of our complexity issue. As you can imagine, the Department of Defense has been doing war planning for a very, very long time and has some very set ways in doing that. This is very different. And it's something that both from a bureaucratic and intellectual standpoint, we have been working on both changing and understanding inside the Pentagon. Let me say a few words about how we think about long-term planning and analysis in the Department of Defense. And it sounds to me, from what I just heard just from the brief introduction and some comments that some folks have given me since I've been here, it may tread on some very similar ground that you've already discussed today. As I try to look for the Secretary of Defense at what the future security environment is, and therefore the types of challenges and opportunities that the Department of Defense needs to prepare for, it is, by definition, a very complex problem for a number of reasons, which I call kind of horizontal and vertical reasons. The horizontal reasons are the range of issues we need to deal with in the Department of Defense. This is no longer an international system where one can look around the world, pick some subset of adversaries, look at what their military capabilities are, and simply do planning based on some balance sheet calculation. We've done that in the past. There were reasons for that. Those reasons do not apply in the current international security environment. This is an extremely complex set of interdependent, interrelated variables that we need to manage and understand that go beyond what traditionally we in the Department of Defense have looked at. I'll give you just one example that would seem fairly straightforward but adds a level of complexity that the department is still working on, is including in a better planning, using better planning assumptions with regard to economic considerations of conflict, ensuring that we understand not only the potential implications of conflict for economics, but the potential implications of economics for conflict, not just in the areas of trade and finance, but also in the areas of resource scarcity, energy flows, et cetera. The other way that this is complicated in more of a what I call vertical or longitudinal sense is the time dynamic. We in the Department of Defense need to have some fairly robust time assumptions with regard to what we're timing for. For better or for worse, I will argue for worse, it takes us a long time to develop the types of capabilities that serve the Department of Defense. As a result, we do fairly long-term planning out to 10, 20, and 30 years out. As you can imagine, each step out in time that you take adds probably exponentially levels of complexity to what we're trying to plan for. And I need to manage that type of complexity for my senior leadership as well. I need to give them useful information to plan in those kinds of long-term time frames, but in a way that's manageable for them and not overwhelming. The other dimension, and I don't know where it falls, I guess it's a third dimensional piece, is the human dynamics piece. And it sounds like you all have not only a great appreciation for that, but have already discussed that as well. I've told a couple of people here already, you know, we've tried to deal with this complexity by trying to take a systems analysis approach and seeing if we could get a handle on all these different types of variables. And the missing piece has always been for us the human dynamics piece, especially when you're dealing with human actors in the system who are not only actively making decisions and changing their approaches as they go through time in these systems, but in fact are watching you and your decisions and purposely changing their decisions in order to gain greater advantage over you. When you add all of these things together, the problem set that we're dealing with in the Department of Defense, I think, is by definition complex. The other thing it is, especially when you add the time frame in, is I think it just features an extremely great, large amount of uncertainty with regard to what we're planning for. So what I talk about a lot in the department is that we are trying to manage that uncertainty over time. We are trying to ensure that we have the right strategies, strategic approaches, but also the right capabilities to manage that uncertainty over time. In the near term, in terms of the types of near-term operations we are either already involved in, support, or may need to get involved in sometime over the next 0 to 2 or 5 years, and in the longer term, in terms of the types of things we need to prepare for, either in terms of building relationships, training, or building capabilities as well. And then in the much longer term, as you all know, Department of Defense thinks a lot about long-term science and technology research and development as well. So managing that uncertainty is really critical for us. The way I would argue that we are trying to tackle that in the Department of Defense is increasingly by relying on adaptability. So the Department of Defense traditionally has a very long and I think very proud history of planning, but it is also a very narrow and very deep history of planning. And what I mean by that is if you look at the sorts of things we planned for and the ways in which we planned for them, they tend to be very narrow projections or predictions about what the department needs to do, and then very, very deep, very, very detailed plans for how to do it. Now, in cases where we thought we had a pretty good handle on the range of uncertainty, that's actually quite an effective planning model. It actually gets you down into the details to sometimes discover challenges or opportunities that you wouldn't have expected if you didn't get down to that level of detail. On the other hand, when uncertainty is greater, and especially when you're wrong about your prediction, it's a very bad way of planning, and we've seen the results of that over the past 10 years, for example, that when you're planning for a certain contingency and it turns out the conditions are very, very different than what you expected, adjustment, because you planned so deeply, because you have been so focused for so long, is very, very difficult. So we are actively trying to change what is truly a bureaucratic culture in the department to become more adaptable. And that means rather than planning deeply for very precise types of predictions or forecasts, to really pull up and understand that there's a much broader range of challenges and opportunities in the future that we need to look at. One of the projects that I ran when I was working for the research institute that was referenced earlier is doing alternative futures work. And that's some work that I brought into what we're doing in the Department of Defense as well, scoping out a range of potential futures so we understand what the different types of challenges might actually be. As we look at these ranges, one of the things I have found, especially working inside the Pentagon, is that we have to have some tangible representation of these ranges. It is not helpful for me to go to my bosses and basically say, there's a lot of stuff out there that could happen. I need to be able to say, and here's what you need to worry about. So that's where we bring the scenario-based planning into play, and I think I've heard that you've had some discussions about that already as well. And we will, what we call instantiate or represent these alternative futures and the challenges therein through scenarios. We will develop scenarios. They're not meant to be predictions, again. They're just representations of these types of challenges. But as you can imagine, this really helps you get your brain around, understand what how these challenges might manifest themselves and what it might actually mean to decision makers. So we do this scenario-based planning across these ranges, as I just said, and then we do one more thing. We do it again, and we do it again, and we do it again, and we do it again. It's an iterative process. And the reason we think that that's so important is not only is that does that allow us to respond to changes more. So in the past, again, that deep and narrow planning that I talked about would take years, right? So I'd have one scenario, and it would take me probably 2 to 3 years to develop all the data and information that helped me understand what I needed to do in that scenario. And again, if that's the scenario that you have to deal with, that's not a bad situation. On the other hand, when things change, it's very difficult to change that process because it was a 2-year process, and starting that machine all over again is very difficult. So we have now reinvented basically our processes to ensure that we can do this in a more iterative way and make adjustments as we go along. And the adjustments, frankly, are on both sides. One, to changes in external conditions, which, as you can imagine, with the complexity I just mentioned earlier, is not only likely, but it's inevitable, frankly, but also changes to internal conditions, because in a place like the Department of Defense, you get changes in leadership, you get changes in opinions, you get changes in judgment. We need to be able to reflect those as well. So ranges, scenario-based, iterative. There's one more item I would highlight for you in terms of what we do. And let me do that by telling you a little bit more about my office. So the strategy office, in addition to doing long-term planning issues, does what we call cross-cutting issues. That's my favorite term for it. The other term that's often used in the department for what my office does is stuff that doesn't fit in any of the other offices. Now, that might seem derogatory. Sometimes I feel like it is. But really, it's not, because there's more and more things coming into my office. And the reason it's coming into my office, quite frankly, is if you look at the nature of the global context, it's not well-suited for the kind of organizational structures we've had in the past in government. So if you took a look at my organization, OSD Policy, you'd see some what seem like very sensible line charts. We've got regional offices that deal with regions in different ways, and we can argue about where the boundaries are drawn, but still, they cover the world eventually. We've got a few functional offices that cover some key functional issues like cyber, space, weapons of mass destruction, that sort of thing. And overall, if you could probably add up all your issues and say they're covered there somehow, and yet things continue to fall through the cracks. The interdependencies between regions, the interdependencies between functional issues and regional issues, the global context, which sometimes changes your view on an issue even if it exists within a region, all of these things are missing in our organizational structure. So I used to think we needed to change our organizational structure until I sat down with a blank piece of paper and realized that I could not possibly come up with another organizational structure that would address those problems, at least not in a way that I could understand. So the third thing I would highlight, in addition to the managing uncertainty piece, the adaptability piece, is I simply have decided to respond to this aspect of complexity by emphasizing networking in our approach. So each of my staff members and all of the folks we deal with, as far as I'm concerned, are elements of that network. We reach out constantly to a very wide range of other players who have relevance to the work we do, whether that's within the Department of Defense, so there would be other parts of OSD policy, those regional shops I talked about, the functional shops I talked about, whether it's in the joint staff who have likewise an organizational structure of regional and functional shops, whether it's in the combatant commands and regional commands, whether it's in the State Department and AID, whether it's in the Commerce Department and Treasury, Department of Energy, internationally, international organizations. The only way I've been able to manage that part of the complexity is to simply basically encourage everyone to network early and network often in this iterative process I just described. Quite frankly, it works better at some times than at others, but it's going to be a necessary ongoing effort on our part to do that. Let me conclude by just saying one last thing. So I've talked to you a little bit about our approaches for trying to deal with what we consider an extremely complex set of issues, trends and drivers, particularly over the long period of time. But I'll emphasize that to us, as important as the methodologies and processes and people we have to support it, and that's all critical for an iterative process. If you don't have those in place, it's very difficult to keep doing this kind of iterative review. But what's as important as all of that is the output. And we have been giving a lot of thought to the output. And the reason for that, again, as I said earlier or alluded to earlier, is we need to provide output that our senior decision makers, in our case, ultimately, at least the Secretary of Defense, if not the President, can at least have an informed discussion about and at best make a decision on. And if the output is extremely, of our process, is extremely complex, nuanced, and basically mind-boggling, it does not serve either of those purposes well. On the other hand, if the output overly simplifies the problem, we are not serving our purposes well either. So finding the right balance between representing the complexity and uncertainty in what we do, but presenting it in a useful, usable way to decision makers so that they can, again, minimally have a good discussion on it, maximally actually make a decision on it, is a big challenge for us. And I'm not going to argue we have the secret sauce on that. And we are looking, in fact, at many other people's approaches to how they present this type of complexity. But I will just leave with that particular thought being a very important consideration in thinking about how to manage complexity, because there is limited value in being able to come up with the best, most complicated way to deal with, most complex way to deal with complexity, if you cannot present it in a way that will ultimately be useful to decision makers. Thanks.
Thank you. Dana, that was really, really interesting, and we're going to come back to this communication point. I have to say, though, let the record reflect that this is the first government policymaker I've ever heard of who looked at an org chart and decided they weren't going to mess around with it.
I tried.
All right, let's turn to Simon. Simon, how about your overview from your world of genomics and bioinformatics?
Right. So clearly, genomics and bioinformatics, a little bit different subject matter than perhaps you're used to hearing. So I'll talk a little bit about that first, just to introduce the area. So I imagine many of you over the last sort of 10, 15 years have heard of the Human Genome Project. That's kind of like the crowning glory, as it were, of genomics as it currently stands, whereby scientists went in and said, we'd like to sequence the human genome, all 3 billion, give or take a bit, base pairs. And the benefit of that was to be able to get that complete sequence, identify the individual components of it, so it made it easier to study. And that in itself is an intellectually interesting exercise. But a lot of the fundamental goal of that is ultimately to impact human health. And that's a big trend that you would imagine would be sort of inherent in what scientists do in the biological sciences, but it's become a very sort of more prominent trend in recent years through initiatives from the National Institutes of Health, like the Clinical and Translational Science Awards, which have looked at basic research, basic clinical research, and said, we're putting all this money into research that's meant to benefit human health. How can we be sure, and can we measure, and can we demonstrate that it's actually making people healthier? And I think there are parallels to some extent in the community that we have here. We're putting all this money into building countries and sort of putting development and aid in. Is it actually helping? Can we demonstrate that we're helping? And so this has been an emerging sort of movement, shall we say, in biology and in particularly biomedicine. So inherent with a lot of the genomics that we've been doing has been data, and that has been driven by technology. So it enhances advances in machines and technology and approaches that we can take that would enable you to do in a few minutes in a research establishment today would have taken you days at a bench only 10 years ago. When I used to do DNA sequencing, there was big glass plates that were this big. If you got sort of 500 base pairs out of that after a couple of days worth of experimenting start to finish, you were pretty happy. Now there's a bench top machine, which is a little bit bigger than your coffee maker, that will be generating terabytes of data in hours. And so it's just a phenomenal difference. And so that has driven a lot of our complexity in terms of data management. And that's one of the things I want to sort of try and return to a little bit with this is a lot of the work that we do with bioinformatics, certainly my slice of that, is helping people manage information. Yes, it is data. Some of it is data. It's numbers, it's values, it's something that might sit in an Excel table. But it's also literature, it's knowledge, it's helping people take the raw stuff that's floating around both in their labs, their colleagues' labs down the corridor, their compatriots sort of around the country and around the globe, how can they bring that together relatively painlessly and enable it to inform their decisions? So they're not just working, you know, on the information that they have access to locally, but can they sort of leverage all the other data that's out there in an appropriate way? So the two projects I'm going to talk a little bit about in general terms are, the first one is genome databases. And so with biology, you know, as Tim maybe will touch on, there are a lot of species that come under that heading. And in biomedical research, we work on different organisms because they have different levels of complexity. Let's say at the top of the complexity level is us, humans. We're incredibly complex. You can then go down the scale, you know, through fruit flies and down to yeast, which is a single cellular eukaryotic organism, down to E. coli and so on and so forth. That's one way we manage complexity. You study a system in a less complex organism like E. coli, and then, you know, you translate that result up to a more complex organism. It doesn't always translate exactly, but that's certainly one way we've managed complexity. But as a result of these different organisms being sort of used in study, there are different communities that build around that, and there's a huge amount of information generated for those different organisms. And one of the challenges researchers face is, how do they get their hands on it? Where do they find it? It's scattered all around the world and in all sorts of different places. It's in literature. It's in Excel spreadsheets, in supplementary information and journal articles. It's all over the place. And one of the roles that we've played, particularly in the genome database community, is saying, okay, we need a place where you can have a fighting chance of finding most of this important data in a somewhat of a one-stop shop. And so there's probably seven or eight different genome databases that are out there, and they focus on bringing in information about that particular organism. So the project I worked on was the rat. So we would have a lot of information about the rat genes, what they did, how they related predominantly to human disease, and then researchers would come in, and they could find a lot of that data there. It initially started off just as a collection of links to some extent. Here's where this data set lives. Here's a link to the file. Very simplistic, but incredibly useful to people to be able to find that stuff. And it's evolved over the years to be a far more integrated sort of information system where you can run analyses, you can sort of do complicated searches and get at data. So it evolves over time, but, you know, just having a collection of information in one spot to tell you where to find things is a wonderful place to start. And then it can get more sophisticated from there. So in terms of the complexity that we deal with in the science, I'm not going to go too much into any of the experimental details, but the complexity our user community finds is there's a wide variety of experimental techniques that people use to find out information about a gene. The scientists deal with that? How do they get access to it? There are lots of different disciplines that we now have to bring to bear on any given problem. I started my life as a biochemist, and we studied, you know, one residue of one protein, and we thought that was what we did. Then I moved to genomics, where we're dealing with the entire genome. And I thought, wow, I'm never going to have to go back to dealing with one protein again. But then after a while, I realized that, okay, the genome's great, but we still need people who are studying individual genes. So then you come back again, and then you have to go up the scale to looking how these systems are integrated at a physiological level. And then, you know, when you look at disease, it's a disruption at the physiological level, which you then have to translate down to molecules, which may be down to genes, and then maybe down to an intervention that you can sort of use with a drug. And so you're constantly going up and down the scale of complexity, trying to make an association between a disease, let's say, and the treatment. So the ways we've tried to approach that is, you know, bring it all together. One of the other things which I think Sheldon was touching on a little bit in terms of presentation and sort of communication of complexity that the genomics field particularly has done a lot of work in is visualization. So if I look at a particular DNA sequence, you know, it's just a long line of letters. That's really all it is at its fundamental level. But if you look at the amount of information that's now available for that piece of DNA sequence, both in terms of the organism of interest, shall we say. So if you go and look at what they call them genome browsers. So the University of California, Santa Cruz, has one of the most popular genome browsers. You can go in there, and you'll see the linear base pairs. But then underneath that are track after track, so layers of information which you can then visualize. And that gives you a way to turn that on, turn it off, sort of prioritize how you see it. But that gives us as humans, frankly, a way to look at a sequence and visualize patterns. That's what we're good at. We're good at seeing seeing colors and seeing patterns and making visual associations. Table of data, it may have the same information, but it is far harder to interpret. And so visualization of information has been a key, I think, benefit that our community has found to really present and understand and make it possible for people to get their hands around what is going on. The last thing I'll touch on before I hand over to Tim here is when I came to this panel, I was, as a genomicist, as it were, and a bioinformatician, we deal with data, numbers, and database, and it's kind of stuff, hardware, software. But I think the complexity that I see in the peace-building field, at least one key element of it is, we're dealing with humans, people. They're changing their mind. They're doing all the things that humans do and don't predict and don't dare to try and predict some of those things. But as I stood back and looked at what we're doing in our line of work, we have clearly, we're dealing with people doing science. So we have a lot of those same issues. We just tend to ignore them. we'll have a collaboration and we'll wonder why it didn't work. We won't think to ask someone who studies, teams and who could have probably told us, years ago, this won't work unless you do this, this, and this. We typically do not do those types of things. We just complain about our collaborators, let's say. Or, maybe we self-select and only go back and work with the people we like working with because for some reason that we can't put our finger on that collaboration worked.
But is that why you're working on the rat genome rather than the human genome?
could be. But one of the things that has come out of that sort of human side of it, as I was mentioning with the translational research, is there's become an increasing awareness that it's not sufficient just to, do clinical research here and not move it down the line. It's not sufficient for the people who are actually talking to the community to just talk to the community and not pass that information back. So we have these silos. And a lot of the efforts of the work that's going on now is to break those down to say, okay, if you want to translate basic research from, the bench, as it's called, to the bedside, you're going to have to talk to all these different communities that you've never really spoken to before. You may have spoken to a couple of them, but you need to know what's going on. You need to know who's doing what and to whom. And so we've put a lot of effort into a bit like was described earlier with the survey that's been done here, who is the peacekeeping community. We've done similar exercises within our own institutions and within these centers to say, who are the researchers? What are they doing? If I'm interested in this particular type of research, can I find someone who can help me? So the networking that you were mentioning, we're having to build systems that keep track of people that enable us to run those searches and find access to equipment, access to reagents and methodologies that we need to complete the piece of the puzzle. So it's no longer sufficient to do it yourself. You need other people, other gear, other stuff. And how do you find them? And how do you bring them all under the same roof to productively collaborate? And there's a lot of effort going into methods to find those people, collaborative spaces, wikis, and so on are one way to do it, trying to sort of manage the people side of things. And there's probably more that I could say about that. But that's kind of the two areas we focused on. There's complexity in the data and the systems we're studying. We've managed that with information management techniques, amongst other things, of visualization. And then there's also the people side of things, which I don't think we're as good at, but we're wrestling with that as we go, and I suspect that's something we can learn from this community from.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you very much. I hope you all are thinking about, pressing them on some of these areas that I think we need to work on. I have this theory about the lack of resources in our field that's been coming up in the morning, and we saw it in your survey. Melanie mentioned it, that the lack of resources in the peace-building field, my theory is, has a lot to do with this communications piece, our inability to communicate the complexity effectively, as well as the networking piece, where you've heard a lot about the silos as well. So I hope folks will be thinking about how to elicit more information from these folks when we get to Q&A, which we will very quickly after Tim and Bernard. Tim?
Okay. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'm honored to have been invited, and at the same time feel very humbled to feel that there's something that I can say that speaks to the big issues that I've been hearing people talk about over the last day. I'm not a peace builder, I'm an ecologist, but I find myself working very frequently in conflict situations. I'm kind of drawn to it to some extent, and I've, when Melanie thanked her parents today, I had the opportunity, the blessing to thank my mother before she died, that The major skills that I use in my discipline are the skills that I learned being the eighth of 10 children around the dinner table. And that was how to negotiate, how to deal with people who have different types of issues. And it was interesting because you mentioned about resources. I'm not trained in conflict, but I see the world through a conflict lens. And what I found out when I, as an ecologist, got involved in my position at the university, I was comfortable in conflict situations. I wasn't comfortable with conflict, but I could function within that. And what happened was it actually leveraged a lot of resources for me in my laboratory. So it kind of moved into that area. Because what I found, and what I'd like to talk about here in terms of complexity, is sort of ecological knowledge and ecological thinking. Because when I get asked to be part of situations, it's usually when there has been a damaged ecosystem with some potentially responsible parties and some type of legal framework that is trying to address that problem. And I get asked to come in because there's the sense that ecological science can somehow bring objectivity to the situation, that can somehow provide the information that will, through some way, mediate the solution, that will bring people to some sort of understanding to say, okay, this is the path. When in fact, what we find when you really look closely at the type of complexity that I deal with as an ecologist is that the definition of ecology, the structure and the function of nature, is so dependent upon your metaphors of knowledge. If you think about the world in terms of mechanistic construction from, you know, like the genome up, you have a very different perspective on how to create cause and effect towards truth. If you come at it from an anthropologist perspective or the humanities where data are sort of constructed through narrative, you know, you work in the Danube Delta and you realize that the people who have evolved their cultures within an environment and have the economic system that's working within that context has a very different way of generating knowledge and generating data and generating truth. And as an ecologist, what I find myself having to do is as a systems thinker, as a person who is trained to think about feedbacks and cause and effect in ways of complexity where you have indirect effects are the norm. Being able to build up from a sort of reductionist view and combine that with the holistic view is really where we find ourselves having to try to integrate. And this feeds a lot into what you were talking about earlier in terms of risk assessment. I think William Ruckelshaus, the first director of the EPA, I believe, defined risk assessment as, how did he define it? As a shotgun marriage between science and policy. It's managing under uncertainty because very often in these complex systems you don't have certainty, but you have to be able to deal with your stakeholders that see the world and truth and cause and effect in various different ways. So that's the perspective that I come at this discussion today. In terms of biological complexity, you know, you have very different perspectives. You have sort of the down and across of like a genome project where you're kind of building up in terms of understanding of nature. On the other hand, you have very important initiatives from the National Science Foundation and the Department of Agriculture looking at long-term ecological research where they're bridging basically up and over. So we have these different types of initiatives trying to deal with understanding these systems. The challenges from my perspective, and I'll speak a little bit of it from the standpoint of my academic background as a professor working to try to develop transdisciplinary thinking is that we have some very significant problems at the university level with how we compartmentalize and how we train and how we develop knowledge. I'm fond of the anonymous quote about how biologists think they're chemists, chemists think they're physicists, physicists think they're God, and God thinks he's a mathematician. You know, there's this hierarchy of what we think is closer to the truth. And now we have a new biomath program, and I'm finding out that the mathematicians think they're biologists. So the whole cycle is complete. And I think we have the same type of disciplinary hierarchy that's created silos within how we perceive our own truths. Where this really came, it hit me so clearly, was for the past, I forget how many years now, at least 10 years, was largely driven by a response personally to 9/11, I've started taking students overseas to do study abroad research programs where they would work with students, a project funded by the National Science Foundation where we would take engineers, we would take anthropologists, and we would take biologists, and they would work with Romanian students to try to develop indicators for sustainable development. And what I found in terms of the discussion yesterday that we're having about, I forget what was it called, empathy or sort of overlap, the indicators they were describing, is that I would find greater conflict between the disciplines within the American students and a lack of empathy between our disciplines greater than the differences in understanding between the different cultures. And part of that is because when we face ambiguity, many of us retreat back to the security of our disciplines, of our journal articles, of our resumes. And that's really where I'm trying to, as an ecologist, come up with different ways of thinking, ecological thinking, that, and part of it is communicating these different types of uncertainty that people who work at a mechanistic level are comfortable with their data being used at a different level. They don't feel like they're violating their prime directive because they don't know, for example, with chemicals of emerging concern in the environment, we can't prove that this particular chemical is causing this particular impact on children's health. But if we take it from a larger scale level and a holistic level, we can use big data tools from throw out words like, you know, neural networks and self-organizing maps, and we can actually discern back using tools, for example, some of you may be familiar with predictive analytics, the example of the woman who, or the young daughter who received prenatal vitamin advertising from Target because they were able to discern from sort of these types of patterning and getting these to kind of meet together when it comes to making decisions. Now, where this comes into play, for me, I'll give you an example that maybe we can come back to a little bit later, is ecological integrity. We have the Clean Water Act in the United States, which very profoundly back in the 70s set it as a national priority to protect, preserve, and maintain the physical, chemical, and biological integrity of our nation's waters. And what this has set in place is a whole series of issues and conflicts, because when that ecological system or that biological system is not meeting the designated uses, all of these non-attainment issues come into play, and we have to start using data, we have to start using models, and we have to start using a whole array of tools to deal with the complexity of human-environment interactions. And where a lot of our work has been focused, and my basic research has been focused, is how do we develop, how do we monitor, and how do we build in a data-informed, a knowledge-informed system that brings into the human end aspects, the economic, the social, the cultural aspects, the human health aspects, and bring those together into a system where the indicators can both meet the needs of communicating to the public, they're valuable, there's something that they're involved with, as well as have the scientific legitimacy that allow us to go in and deal with the mechanisms of adaptive management. There's a tremendous literature on this that you can find, but what I like about this approach is that now with bringing in the humanities, bringing in the social scientists, what we've been able to do is develop certain pathways that can be followed simultaneously. We can deal with, when we get these data and indicators together that are based upon good science and good understanding, they are developed in collaboration with the stakeholders in the watershed. The policymakers are involved in deciding what's of value to be monitored. But then we have the analytical approaches with these where you can start getting sort of the models as mediators, as I talked about. At the same time, by putting in the process of assessment, you're developing sort of stakeholder ownership, and they get involved in owning the process of the analytical frameworks. And then finally, you set up the participatory route, and you use, for example, watershed, you use that as the vehicle to, in this case, to get the people and the stakeholders engaged. And that was what we were trying to do and implement in some of the work that we were doing in the Balkans.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you very much. I tell you, each one of these presentations is equally riveting, and we could go on and on in each field because it's a very rich topic. Let's go to Bernard here in the engineering world.
Thank you, Sheldon. Before I talk about complexity and uncertainty, I'd like to give you a little bit an idea of the context in which I practice my engineering. Over the past 10, 15 years, I've been involved in engineering for developing communities. So essentially, I'm mostly addressing the basic needs of about 3 to 4 billion people on the planet whose job is to try to stay alive at the end of the day. So we are talking about water, sanitation, energy, shelter, transportation, very small-scale stuff. Most of the work that I'm doing is on small-scale communities. It's very hard for me to understand big cities. So small-scale communities generally characterized by low capacity, high vulnerability, and therefore communities that are barely resilient and mostly at risk when faced with adverse events, ranging between small-scale events, could be the loss of somebody in a family, all the way to big disasters. So we're talking about a very complex and uncertain type of environment. What I've learned over time is that that complexity and uncertainty comes from the fact that we are dealing with systems, systems of systems that are all interacting. And among the systems, economic, financial, infrastructure, environmental systems, we have human systems. So there's one system that is completely strange is the human system. And for us engineers, it's mostly on trying to understand this concept of bounded rationality. Dr. Simon in the 1960s, 1970s was talking about it. And in some cases, I can tell you it's more than bounded rationality. It's unbounded unrationality. So as engineers, obviously, how do we comprehend that? And how do we essentially address such complexity? And the ultimate goal of the work that I'm doing is really to create healthy and peaceful communities. There's a lot of attributes to making such communities healthy and peaceful, and that's, I can tell you, that's extremely difficult, especially at the small-scale level. I want to quote Albert Einstein, problems cannot be solved with the same level of thinking that created them. Therefore, there's no way we can understand and address complexity and uncertainty with the tools that we have today. Therefore, we need to think of a different new mindset and also use tools that are a bit different from those that we are using today that tend to be more linear and cause and effect in nature. Creating peaceful and healthy communities does not happen by itself. It takes time. It takes a lot of patience. It takes a lot of humility. I'm working on a book right now. I'm finishing a book on engineering and development that has nothing to do with engineering. It has to do mostly with the interaction of engineering with other disciplines. What I've learned in working in various countries around the world that creating peaceful and healthy communities requires participation and empowerment, people first, reflective and adaptive practice, design as you go. It has to be contextual. What works in a small village in Afghanistan does not necessarily work for the same a small village in Africa. We need to have a systems approach, and we need an integrated approach. In the kind of work that I do and in the classes that I teach, I really emphasize the need for engineers to interact with other disciplines. A lot has to do with non-engineering stuff. If all problems in the world were technical, we would have solved them by now. We know that. So bringing water, bringing sanitation, bringing energy, bringing transportation to any place on the planet, I can do it. That's easy. But making sure that those projects are contextual in nature, are respectful of the culture, are respectful of the people, are empowering the people, and more importantly, that they are long-lasting, that's a different story. The work that I have done so far, I can tell you that if there's one thing that I can tell you is that there's no such thing as the best unique solution to community development. Forget it. There's no such thing as the best unique solution to community development anywhere on the planet, as far as I know. You may want to consider instead of something that Dr. Schoen in the 1980s came up with. He said instead of trying to optimize our solution, we should satisfy our solution. Satisficing is a term that combines sufficiency and satisfying. In other words, there's no way in the development work, in the development world, that I can come up with one unique best solution for a village. That's impossible. If you can do that, let me know, and I will be glad to duplicate it in all the countries where I'm working. But it is possible to come up with good enough solutions. And that's what satisficing is about. Good enough solutions that are respectful of the people, respectful of the culture, that essentially focus on the talent. People know how to mediate at the local level. We may want to think about that maybe conflict resolution is a two-way street. We may want to explore how people in Africa and in Afghanistan mediate conflict. Maybe there's something to learn there instead of maybe going to those countries and telling them what to do, right? Just an opinion. But what I want to do is to emphasize this idea of satisficing and reflective practice. In other words, when I'm in a field, and I'm mostly in a field, there's no way I can come up with a very well-defined strategy to community development. It changes as I go. It changes every day as I interact. And it's that concept of reflective practice. Reflective practice is Dr. Schoen, 1983, a great book called The Reflective Practitioner that you may want to explore. How do we practice reflection as we do things in a constrained type of environment? So the process that we use in our project consists of appraisal, design, implementation, monitoring and evaluation, very important. I think in peace building, monitoring and evaluation needs to be in place. How do you monitor the dynamic of the community? And how do you react to it? And then also the exit strategy. It's a good idea to have an exit strategy on anything you do, and more importantly, the long-term sustainability of project. I look at peace from a systems point of view. It's not a goal. It's not an outcome. If you're dealing with systems of systems, peace is an emergent property. The same way as speed is in your car, it's an emergent property. Health is an emergent property, an emerging property from the interaction of parts. Where is the speed box in your car? There's no speed box in your car. Speed comes from the interaction of parts that are healthy. You need to change the belts, you know, put some fluids, you need to change the battery. It's that interaction that creates speed, something about health and something about peace. It's not an end game. You cannot grab peace. But you know when it's not peaceful. That's an inequality in many ways. So the tools that I've been using, and I'm working actually on the second book, which is Systems Dynamics Tools for Development, is to deal with systems. The field of system dynamics has been going on since the 1950s. I suggest that you look at the work of Dr. Jay Forrester at MIT in the 1950s. Essentially, what systems tools allow you to do, and in a mathematical way, and in a reflective way, is to explore the what if solutions. What if something were to happen, say, to a drought? There's a drought. What if that drought happens? And you can do projections. What will be the consequences on the health of the people, on the economy of the people, on the stability of the community, and so on and so forth? Those tools are available today. And for us engineers, we have not used them for essentially dealing with people. Engineers and people, you know, it's not a good interaction. I'm trying to change that. And it allows for parametric and sensitivity analysis. What if? Let's change, essentially, over a period of 10 years, let's look at climate change. What is going to be the impact of climate change, say, a year from now, 2 years from now, on a community that relies on so many inches of water per year? What if? I think that's the beauty about system thinking and also being able to identify critical parameters. Systems tools can be combined with social network analysis tools. So there's plenty of tools out there that I urge you to explore. I also urge you, for you guys in the field of peace building, to team up with folks in science and technology. Peace building won't happen. Peace will not happen without water, sanitation, energy, shelter, transportation, and so on and so forth, and vice versa. The two are intertwined. So you guys are mostly right brain. Engineers are mostly left brain. It would be nice maybe to combine the two together and come up with whole brain thinking and whole brain solutions. Thank you.
Between the two of us. All right. Thank you, Bernard. All right, folks, I promised time for questions. Let's move the microphones down here. We have really heard some interesting, lots of overlap, but also lots of distinguishing characteristics that we've heard about. Bernard talking about the good enough rather than the optimizing, rather than the optimal solution set. Tim talking about the process of defining, developing indicators across a broad community. And I was hearing with Simon emphasizing the data-driven decision-making, and Daniel talking about uncertainty, adaptability, and networking. Again, overlap across lots of these presentations, but interesting where they put the emphasis. Yes, we've got a question down here. Can you identify yourself, your organization, and there you go.
Sure. I'm Ted Johnson at the Heller School at Brandeis University. Thank all four of you for this fascinating discussion. I've been concerned for a long time about the issue of silos and the stratification of our work. And so two concepts come to mind, and I just share them with you and put it into a question. One comes from E.O. Wilson, whose book, I see Tim shaking his head, the Diversity of Life, in which he talks about this concept of consilience. And in consilience, if you imagine four squares, and each square was designated as a discipline. Say we had peace building, and we had anthropology, and we had science, and ecology. That where those squares meet in the center, according to Wilson, if you drew a circle around that, is the area of potential new learning, which is something that comes from the overlap of those disciplines. So that the problem that we encounter often in academics is that the science and ecology and peace building are all in different buildings, they're on different places on the campus, and people don't interact with each other. And that Wilson is arguing that we should perhaps find some way for those to come together. Structurally, it's not set up. And so that becomes a structural barrier to us beginning to apply this new knowledge that's potential. And the other person whose concept I'll mention is Milton Bennett, who talks about the developmental model of intercultural sensitivity, where people are often afraid of new environments, they're afraid of getting outside of their cultural comfort zone. And his argument essentially is when we reach a place where we can move at the margins of other cultures without losing our own cultural identity, then we're at a place where we can move comfortably without being threatened by new information. And so that's kind of a psychological motion or psychological move to deal with structural barriers. I don't want to go any further on that, but just take those two concepts. I'm wondering if you deal with that in your work to somehow overcome the structural barriers and the psychological barriers. The psychological barriers in academics, we don't have time. There's different funding issues. There's different competition and all kinds of things that go on. But we'll need, it seems to me, to find both a way to deal with the structural barriers through a psychological approach. You use anything similar to that in your work, or you have anything that you can advise us on how we might deal with those things?
So let's break that into two pieces. Somebody want to take the structural piece and another the psychological piece, Tim?
I can mention, because in preparing for this, I was going through a literature review, and there's some wonderful work that's being done that I was aware of before, but I never thought about it within this context, that kind of bridges consilience theory, and there's a whole consilience society, but it's using resilience theory and bridging between. Resilience theory is this idea that you have sort of the cycle between growth phases and then conservation phases. And in biology, you think of it as sort of our selecting, where species grow rapidly, but then communities develop sort of a conservative phase where you're kind of building up structure and kind of maintaining yourself to stand up against stress. But then those systems break down, they have to get reorganized, and then they go back through a cycle. So it's this sort of classic sort of resilience theory. But it was an interesting paper that just came out that I'll tell you about, I can share it with you, that talks about that being applied to social systems, particularly in how universities have to reorganize their thinking with respect to these long-term ecological research settings because they have to go through this reorganizational phase and it touches on the psychology. So there was a really good example of consilience bridging to resilience theory and being applied across those borders. And that was a very good paper. I've shared that with a couple of people here since I've arrived. Yeah.
Okay. We want to make sure we take as many questions as possible. So is there one over here?
Andrew Tomlinson from the Quaker UN office. It stops. Ah, there we
are. It stopped again.
I can speak very loudly.
There you go.
Go ahead.
Well, maybe we change the battery.
One of the problems that we deal with a great deal, I think, in the peace-building field is actually ignorance.
That's right.
And these are very complex systems we're dealing with. We try to do our conflict analyses. We know that they're not as good.
I'm sorry.
Looking and trying to replicate these systems in a more analytical way, it also pushes us a lot of the time towards working methods of continually trying also, as well as to understand and listen, to actually act and then be able to respond to the actions. And that, I think, the reflective practice point is extremely important as almost a daily working method in our field. But I'd love to hear some more reflections on that, of dealing effectively, or your working methods as a way of dealing with your acknowledging that you're actually ignorant of much of the environment in which you work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that this idea of I come from the field of engineering, right? And before I was working in engineering in poor countries, I was in the design of tunnels. How do you design a tunnel? Well, you don't have a clue of what you have ahead of you. And that's really design practice, and yet tunnels are built all the time here for Washington subway system. And essentially it requires a certain protocol where all the different parties, contractors, engineers, and clients get together and agree on that reflective practice ahead of time and looking at various options. And as the more and more data are coming up, all parties get together and make decisions together. So to peace building, you are dealing with a very strong participatory component and empowerment type of component. How do you work? When I work in a small village in Africa, there's a lot of stuff that I have to process. And I really don't know what I don't know even to get started with. And yet I have to come up with solutions that are participatory, integrated, and that are respectful of the culture. Very, very, very difficult. It's a different mindset. It's a different way of practicing engineering. Completely different. It's not the same as doing engineering for building this building here. Completely different. In fact, it does not even exist yet.
Daniel, I think probably it sounds like something along the lines of your adaptability thinking.
Yeah, but it's actually very relevant, related to the question that was the answer that was just provided, which is, so this type of process to me is very much part of the iterative process I'm talking about, and I neglected to mention it, but feedback and monitoring information is absolutely a critical element of that, because that allows you to adapt and to improve and so forth as you go along. So I absolutely agree. And the same kind of shift, whether it's in thinking about this as working models or whether this is about thinking about this as a different, I would argue almost kind of the term I would use is kind of planning culture for this, is something we're in the midst of in the Department of Defense too. And this is actually hugely problematic for us. And I think it may be very similar to the engineering analogy that was just given. I have folks who are very used to saying, tell me what the problem is, and I will tell you what the answer is. It will take them a long time, but they will get you an answer for it. I'm trying to change that dynamic into, let's understand what we currently think the problem is and find out what information we can get on it, present to ourselves to either redefine the problem or, again, allow some subset of decisions to be made with regard to the problem. This is a big bureaucratic cultural change for my department. My department is used to going to leadership saying, here is the answer, thumbs up or thumbs down, okay? And if it's thumbs down, tell me what was wrong with that. I'll come back with another answer. You tell me thumbs up or thumbs down. That sounds like an iterative process, but if you think about it, the problem with it is it, again, tries to solve the problem each time. We're trying to change that now to say, let's provide senior leaderships with the information they need to understand the problem and understand the trade-offs, the risks, the benefits, et cetera, of making the decisions they're making. That does not necessarily solve the problem, and that's a very different mindset, a very different process, and I think necessitates this kind of iterative feedback loop type process in order to make it work.
Which, by the way, is a completely different mindset on the West Coast in software development, in technology companies, where the iterative design process is everything. The conversation is completely different out there about the fast revs. Social media companies are really exemplary in this area, not looking for right answer all the time, but looking for lots of answers all the time.
In fact, I'd say we were trying to learn very hard from that kind of not only iterative but networked, team-based development.
It's a huge mind shift that we need to bring into Washington. Over here, the hand was up there first. Dennis, you want to take the microphone? Thank you.
The name is Dennis Warner. I'm with Catholic Relief Services. I'd like to make a comment on the link of development organizations working at peace building. It was said earlier that most development organizations say they do peace building. But when you look at it, they're not focusing on it. It's sort of a leitmotiv in their work. They say, we build our water projects, or we build roads, or we build houses, and that causes peace. Well, it does, but as the panel here is showing, peace is a much more complex phenomenon than something automatically or spontaneously happening. It has to be directed. It has to be focused on. In my organization, peace building is supposed to be part of all of our programs, but our challenge is we don't know how to bring it down to the project level, to the field implementer, to the project officer, who is not a peace-building expert. And we can't afford to send somebody who spent 20 years studying the field to go and advise him when something happens. So we've got two main challenges, and I think it's not just for us, but for many development organizations. The first is, how do you raise awareness in the developers that peace is something that you have to have some special ideas, some special understanding of, so that they feel it's something that needs to be incorporated in their project. So that's awareness raising. The second challenge is, what tools do you give them? And that's what we're struggling with right now. How do you deal with an upstream, downstream water issue of pollution? How do you resolve a conflict there? How do you resolve a conflict between two ethnic groups over a water source? My field is water, as you can hear. And we don't have the good tools for that. And you can't translate lofty academic treatises easily down at the community level. So I don't have the answer, and I don't know what we will do. It seems it's an iterative process between the people that are working at peace building all the time and those who are working at development all the time. And over time, some kind of an understanding and some kind of progressively improving tools hopefully will arise.
Well, does anybody want to, this is going to have to be our last question because we're 20 minutes late for lunch. I think it's probably more proactive than what you're suggesting there. You're suggesting this will unfold, this way of communicating with one another, and I actually think we could be working a lot harder at sharing these things. But anybody on the panel want to take a quick cut at that, and then we'll call it. Go ahead, Renaud.
We're going to finish with a piece of wisdom. When someone asked the Buddha what is enlightenment, he said a lack of suffering, but he never said what it was. And I think peace is exactly the same thing. We know what it is not, but there are so many ways of reaching a peaceful community. With that, have a good lunch.
Thank you all very much.
I want to thank all of you for joining us, and especially our panel. I think the intellectual firepower on this panel could have lit this building. So thank you. I hope we can continue this discussion. As you saw from our resources, there is no such thing as a free lunch in the field. As much as we would love to feed all of you, I have to limit the people having lunch today to those who are staying for the whole day, where lunch is included. But I do want to ask everyone who's leaving now to please fill out your surveys. And just one more time to thank you and this wonderful panel. Thanks.
Talking, and I think if you up around,